call the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee to order.
It's 1 o'clock.
It's 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And according to our agenda, and we also have 1181 posted. It was posted a little over an hour ago. And the amendments to 2648 will not be available till 4 p.m., and amendments to Senate Bill 194 may or may not be available yet today. And so what we're going to do is jump in, first of all, to work session on House Bill 2938. We have a House rule change before us, members. It's House Rule 15.25. It should be before you. And we'll open a work session on House Rule 15.25. We were allocated 6 months of staff, financing for 6 months worth of staff for the session. The session started on January 11th. Today is July 11th, that's 6 months, and if we pass this rule, from this day forward, we will have allocated $110 per day for staff until the session is finally done. Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, but that wouldn't take care of the allocations from July 1st to July 11th that we have been short?
Well, technically, we have we are budgeted for 6 months. It's not budgeted January through July, or through June, excuse me. It's budgeted for 6 months.
So does that mean that not?
Yeah.
It does not. And basically, from July 1st to July 11th, retroactively go backwards.
No, it does not.
Okay.
It's prospective only.
Prospective only. And just one other question. What did the Senate do, Mr. Chair?
The Senate seems to be a little bit less energetic in pulling their own files and doing their own work, and so they went back retroactive to the end of first of July. And it's my opinion that we shouldn't even do this, that we should just put in a few more hours, pull our own files, and do a little more work, and return our messages as we can. But there is considerable concern among members of the House that we go ahead and allocate some funding for staffing until we have this rule change before us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I certainly want to object to what we're doing. I do feel that actually the right thing might be to do the same thing the Senate did.
Okay, notice for the record.
Do you have a motion on the floor, Mr. Chair? I'm speaking to a motion number.
We don't have a motion.
Does the Chair want a motion?
I would accept a motion to amend House Rule 15.25 as indicated by the bold print. On the page before you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
As a courtesy to the Chair, I so move.
Okay. So the motion before us, colleagues, to amend House Bill 15.25 as indicated. I will read it to you. In the event the regular session exceeds the budgeted 6 months, each member shall be allocated an additional $110 per calendar day for personal staff, services, and supplies as defined in House Rule 16.01 and the legislative newsletter as defined in House Rule 14.30. Yes, that's it.
Good question. Is not the amount of money that's allocated for use during the interim available to a legislative member for staff purposes during the regular session?
Yes, it is.
To this motion.
To the motion.
I'm going to oppose this. I think that there's money available to the members for their staff if they have used the amount that they had allocated. I know for me personally, I have enough left in my account to cover my staff fee this month from the amount that we had. So I think that's the financially prudent thing to do is to oppose this.
Great. I also budgeted my staff and have some carryover to get me by for a while yet.
And if I might, and if you use it all up, you still have money that you had for the interim.
Yeah, your interim fees that can be used, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
If we stay on our announced schedule, this impacts about 5 days. So.
That's correct. If we can get out of here next Friday, which I certainly hope to, we can It would be about 5 days of funding for upper staff reserves. Representative Maddox.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just figured as of June 30th, we ran out of what we had allocated for the session, or you could have held back and carried some over. I think I had the closest to the wire, leaving in fine pencil point sharpening, so that I had $116 left as of midnight, the end of June 30th. And I know I'm drawing on my interim account, but I think that also that meant that two of my part-time people were sent back to my law firm, and they are being paid by the private sector, not by the public sector. And my 12-year-old daughter is doing a great job of helping out as a volunteer, getting great experience. But each person is situated differently. I have not heard a lot of pressure from some of my colleagues to do something for the next few days, and I think it sends the wrong message. I think I'd rather keep the pressure on financially for us to just get out of here. But if three of my colleagues really wanted to do this as a courtesy, I'd send this to the floor.
There has been a considerable amount of concern that has been expressed to me as the Chair of the Rules Committee that we make some change and adjustments. Some of our members are completely out of funds and actually run a little bit of a deficit, I understand, at the end of the session.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then as a courtesy, I'd send it to the floor without agreeing to vote necessarily for it on the floor.
Okay. Ms. Carr?
Well, I would do the opposite. I think that we're either rewarding or not somebody's ability to budget their office. And I think that I think it sends the wrong message for us to do this at this point in the session. So I will oppose the motion.
This is Devlin.
Do we have a motion on the floor?
Yes. Okay. Move it to the floor to do pass recommendation as the motion. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll pass to this on the floor, but I don't know that I will put one to get there.
Okay. Ramona, would you care to come up and clarify the fact that there seems to be a little bit of confusion about budgeting for staffing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ramona Kennedy, for the record, Chief Clerk of the House. Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, just to clarify your question as to whether or not budgeting did end on June 30th. Let me clarify that there's two dates. There is the date of services supplied. And the way that factors is $15.50 a day for 170 calendar days. That would have brought you up to the end of June. But we believe that the leadership believes that the issue was staffing support. That was budgeted 6 months. That's a different time frame. So if you start your budgeting cycle at the beginning of session when that did go into effect, then that would bring you up through July 11th for staffing support. Members who have spoke to me about being able to have ongoing staff support until Franny died, it was believed that that would then, their monies really are sunsetting today on those monies because it was from January 11th to July 11th, which is a 6 month time frame for which they were allocated staff support. But certain supplies was factored on $15.50 a day for 170 days, which would have brought you to the end of June. So it's two different dynamics here. One was based on 170 days, one was based on 6 months.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Devlin.
A couple of members of my conference were talking to me about this, expecting a need, and actually one member of your conference.
I knew who it was.
I'd be willing to move it to the floor. We may have a chance to vote on it.
Chris, please call the roll.
President Meyer?
Aye.
President Devlin?
Aye.
President Edwards?
Excuse?
President Gardner?
Aye.
President Maddox?
Aye.
President Sparr?
No. No. Motion carries. And the rule change goes to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. And any volunteers? Okay. The gardener will carry it to the floor. Okay, let's take care of that little piece of. Piece of work.
One for me.
Yes, it is. We're going now to a work session on House Bill 2938. And would you please bring us up to date?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, you have a supported amendment before you today. At your first meeting, you had dash one. Today, we have the dash three, four, five, six, and seven.
2938.
I'm not sure how many of these you want me to go into.
I know a considerable interest has been expressed from number of individuals about this bill. I am familiar with the number of the amendments, including the threes and sixes. Why don't you go ahead and the ones that you are aware of and familiar with bring us to the point.
All right. Okay. The dash three amendments would restore current law related to ODOT providing services to counties without cost. It would also require that the county governing body exhibit a hardship based on criteria developed by ODOT and the Association of Oregon Counties.
We have updated that. I think the dash six is the one we're interested in.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the dash sixes. These amendments would allow ODOT, upon the request of a county governing body, to provide plans and specifications for bridges or culverts and standard specifications for road location, construction, and maintenance projects without cost. It would also delete a reference in another section of statutes that cross-references with 366-155, which the bill is amending. The dash fours would create an Office of Energy separate from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, require appointment of the administrator of that office to be made by the governor, and transfer spending authority, rights, and obligations to the new Office of Energy. The dash five amendment would allow issuance of lottery bonds to make community sports facilities suitable for Major League Baseball if a team agrees to relocate to a city, requires certain findings, and sets a limit on the amount of bonds to be issued, and that would be determined in the bill, which is carrying a blank at this point.
That's permissive language, it's not mandatory. Mm-hmm. You missed the dash seven.
The dash seven would allow the Department of Administrative Services to provide alternative fuel to public agency and private entity fleets. Specifies the department authority, declares an emergency, and the bill would be effective on passage.
Mr. Graney? Mike Graney in the audience? Come on up, Mike. The dash sevens, you have the fours and sevens, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And the fours are similar to the amendments that we introduced for 194?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Director Mike Craney from the Office of Energy, they're identical to what was on Senate Bill 194 that this committee heard earlier. Simply pulls us out of DCBS, and at this time, neither the Office of Energy nor DCBS has any objections to that. It makes more logical fit, really. And I can talk about the dash sevens too. I'm going to have Steve Vincent from Avista come up with me. Dash seven allows Department of Administrative Services, when they have a motor pool station that is equipped with an alternative fuel vehicle like compressed natural gas, to
make fuel available to other fleets whose cars run on alternative fuels if the fuel's not otherwise available in the community. Something that Department of Administrative Services would like the flexibility to have. This issue just came up the last couple of days, and I talked to Cam Burney, who's the administrator of that division, and he supports that amendment. And there have been some specific instances, I think, in Southern Oregon where there's limited availability of alternative fuels with fleets who would like to be able to take advantage of that.
Steve Vincent of Issue Utilities, the Natural Gas Utility in Medford. We obviously have a lack of natural gas available at privately owned facilities throughout the state. The Department of Administrative Services now has natural gas refueling, for instance, out here on Airport Road is one place. There are a number of places throughout the state, but what the problem that was actually I was first made aware of Wednesday of last week, there are other publicly owned fleets, federal fleets, local fleets like school districts, cities, who need to get from point A to point B are now starting to buy natural gas vehicles to do that. Federal government has some mandates to purchase alternative fuel vehicles. Local governments do not. However, they are doing that as well. The problem is that they can't refuel at a Department of Administrative Services facility. As Josh says, we don't have the authority in statute to do that. We can only serve our own state vehicles. In the bill, or in the amendment, it does identify that the Department of Administrative Services would, in Section 5, could only provide the alternative fuel where it's not available. And that's what we're intending to do. If a privately owned gas station owner put in natural gas refueling, for instance, in Klamath Falls, there's a Shell station owner who's doing this to serve the Air Force Base vehicles that go off base. Anyhow, if there is a private station owner, then this statute would say the Department of Administrative Services can't go forward.
How do we define readily available as on line 15 of the bill? That says that where these alternative fuels are not readily available, the amendment. How are we going to define that? Is it going to have to be 24-hour availability? Is it going to have to be? I'm not interested in providing the Department of Administrative Services a toehold here because competing with they're taking away incentives for private operators to provide the fuel.
Mr. Chairman, but the statute, I guess, leaves that up to Department of Administrative Services to determine in rulemaking, but I think clearly the discussion here and your discussion gives them strong legislative direction as to what the legislative intent is, and that I think that would be helpful guidance when they do their rulemaking on this issue to make sure that it's not open-ended, because that's not the intent, and at least at this point, the department is not interested in having an open-ended ability to do that kind of resale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of the amendment, lines 11 and 12, you talk about the price you're going to charge. And maybe alleviate some of the concerns that I share with the chair about I don't want, you know, the incentive to be gone for private companies to come in and open fueling stations, but want the state government to be competing with them if really there. Maybe we should have put something there that any fuel provider will be at a higher cost than what other available private sources are, not a competitive price.
I would like to see it where if there are two or more private suppliers available that gas would no longer supply. And I think with internet services, we talked about that complex. If there are two or more private ISPs available in a community, that the state will no longer provide to the public internet services. I think it would be appropriate to, and you know, I'm even concerned about that one guy trying to come in and break in a new market. If his competitor is the state.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I would actually like to say that if one other private gas station owner, a private investor, has a natural gas refueling station that the Department of Administrative Services would cease to make their facility available to the public as long as there's some kind of cost recovery on what type of, you know, mechanism they had to put in. But as the natural gas utility, we've spent the last four, maybe even 8 years trying to encourage this development due to the fact we've had a number of fleets come to us wanting to convert their fleets to natural gas. We've attempted to establish privately owned stations along the I-5 corridor and have been unsuccessful with that because of the lack of market. And in some ways, it's us going to the Department of Administrative Services asking them, would you open up your facility to publicly owned vehicles or maybe privately owned vehicles that are traveling down the I-5 corridor for refueling? And I would wholeheartedly agree that if we could hold this authority somehow once private industry is there, that that's what needs to be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would seem to me that we'd be concerned with micromanagement by statute at the same time I share the concerns that have been expressed about impact on the private sector. Forgive me for checking on a license or checking. Couldn't we test this out by putting a sunset on it, say, January 1, 2002? So we'll have to come back and revisit it and see what's happened and hear from folks and see if there's been a negative impact instead of trying to write up all kinds of rules. But, I mean, sure, there ought to be some rules, but that's putting the limitations in the statute then finding out it's not working. There's some pretty good standards here, but then if the standards are being violated from our perspective, have this come back to us next session with a sunset.
Let me respond to that.
Might I ask for a little bit further, possibly 2004, just because my knowledge of how this refueling infrastructure is developing, I don't think anything will happen within 2 years. There's probably one private refueling facility available to the public in the state. Haven't seen it happen. One of the Ford dealerships down there put in their own refueling facility, and it's actually individuals who drive in and refuel, but that's a rare case. I don't think it's going to develop fast enough. I know Northwest Natural is there, and they would probably say the same, that it's just not developing fast enough. And the problem that we have is that for publicly owned vehicles that are mandated to use alternative fuels like the federal government, they're having a problem meeting those mandates because there's no infrastructure available to them to meet those mandates. Well, in some cases, they're buying vehicles that are dual fuel. They meet the mandate, but they continue to run gasoline just because there's no infrastructure available. And you know, the Department of Administrative Services couldn't even be available to federal fleets right now unless this amendment were adopted and passed.
Mr.
Chairman,
I'd certainly be open to making it January 1, 2004 with that information you can.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Byer.
Thank you. Many places in rural Oregon are already experiencing the loss of the regular gasoline stations. What would the effect this have, if any, on that, the people, if all of a sudden you've got a DAP at the gas station there, perhaps will that be more of a sense of people go away from gasoline-powered vehicles and put a greater burden on these rural Oregon
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, the amendment does state that only fleet vehicles, Department of Administrative Services, and interested in serving individuals. I think that would become an administrative nightmare if there were hundreds of them doing that. Rural Oregon also has a lack of natural gas to begin with. There are places throughout the eastern part of the state and even parts of the southern, the south coast, they have no natural gas at all. So this lack of availability might answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, if I might add too, I think this actually could help gasoline stations diversify, because once they see that if there is enough of a market for compressed natural gas, then they would be willing to install their own pumps.
This will help us get the infrastructure that then in turn could, the private sector could install and utilize. So it actually might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Committee, Legislative Council has just advised that the definition referenced in the Dash 7 Amendment to Public Agency does not include the federal government. So that definition would have to have a different reference in order to include federal government.
I think we can take care of that with a question.
Yes, with 2 minutes.
I think we could take care of that with a conceptual amendment.
Okay. You guys have talked to DAS about this?
Yes, that's yes, true.
And they are?
They support this.
Okay.
They do support the provision, and they support limited to fleet, as the amendment does, and they support provisions that are limited to the amendment to where alternative fuel is not available. Yeah. So, in fact, the language that was given to the Legislative Council that is reflected here was drafted by the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it's in there.
Are you in work session?
We are.
To get us rolling, I move adoption of the Dash 7 Amendment, and then I'm going to seek the unanimous consent has been suspending for construction.
Okay. We have a motion, colleagues, to move the Dash 7 Amendment to the House of 938. The objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Yes, I move that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting two conceptual amendments to HB 2938-7.
And that would be to add federal government to the public agencies defined on lines 12 and 13 and to sunset in 2004.
Yes.
Okay, colleagues, any discussion on the motion?
Yeah, before we go there, I'm curious to know what the emergency is. They could put an emergency.
Yeah, I'll know that.
That's an emergency clause in the entire bill. And,
Mr. Chairman, President Barr, I'm not sure at whose request the emergency clause was put in. I do know that there are situations that the Department of Administrative Services has been approached by fleets asking that they supply them, and that they're not able to right now. So this would allow them to respond right away.
This, the longer we go, the less effect this makes, you know. You may be here for January. That would be our normal bill effective date under new legislation. But,
I think that language came at the suggestion of Department of Administrative Services Assistant Attorney General.
Okay. Okay. All right, we have a motion, colleagues, to suspend the rules for purposes of adopting two congressional amendments to the Dash 7 Amendment.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to expand that motion to make it three conceptual amendments so we can take a look at whether we want to delete this emergency clause off.
Okay. The objection? Hearing none to order. Suspended.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
I move that we amend the Dash 7 amendments to add two provisos. One is that we add federal agencies to the listing of public agencies. And secondly, that we sunset this particular part of the bill, just this part of the bill. January 1, 2004. I'll be able to merge the clause separately.
Okay. Is there any objection to the motion, colleagues, to adding public agencies to the definitions, adding the federal government to a definition of public agencies on line 12 and 13 of the Jackson Amendment and adding a sunset provision sunsetting the bill on 1-1-2004. Any objection? Three months ordered. Person Mack.
I move that we delete the emergency clause.
To the motion?
Yeah. While it might be helpful to put an emergency clause and to move this piece of the legislation more quickly, we're
probably going to be making some dramatic changes about engineering in the rest of this bill, and I think that we need a standard implementation date, as with all other legislation, so that people can roll up and get ready for that. They're going to have to change their operational methods, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think that this is important enough, with all due respect, to create a separate operative date within the legislation. I may be hearing differently on that, but 90 days from close the session will take us into October. I think that's reasonable enough to get rolling. It also gives the other folks with the rest of this bill some time to get ready.
This is Star.
Just a question. Just ask if staff could start, getting the rules ready in the 90-day period before the effective date anyway. Okay.
Any further discussion? Any opposition to this objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion carries. Emergency clause is deleted.
And now, Mr. Chair, as I understand, we have the Dash 7 in front of us as amended.
Correct.
Okay.
It's in the bill. We already moved it to the bill. And then conceptually admitted the Dash 7. Mr.
Chairman, do you want another motion?
Yes, I would. Chair, I'd move the Dash 4. Okay, the motion colleagues to move the Dash 4 amendment to the House Bill 2938. As previously discussed, is there any objection?
Okay.
Hearing none, so ordered. Now, Mr. Byer, do you have a motion to move the Dash 5?
Thank you, Chair. I was going to move the Dash 6s.
Okay. I was have a motion to move the Dash 6s into House Bill 2938. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, since all the representatives here at a ballpark we're looking for a age of 18, or that may have let me know if it's that issue.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
Can we get a clarification on the staff report saying that this has been incorporated in Date 25038 and what the necessity is of having this also in statute in terms of bonding authority? 5038 has it, or does it need this?
I was talking, Mr. Chair, committee members, I was talking with Mr. Barkowski at Legislative Council this morning, and we were reviewing the amendments that the committee had for 2938, and he just offered the information that he understood that the identical amendment to the ones that you had as Dash 5 was incorporated into House Bill 5038. And there seems to be an understanding that the committee, the full committee of Ways and Means, will accept the subcommittee's recommendations. That all the information that I have.
Mr. Chairman, service clarification.
Yes, Mr. Devlin.
I've asked this. The committee administrator doesn't know what amount they put into the blank.
No, I do not. And that may not come until the full committee. I don't know if the subcommittee puts the amount in blank.
President Starr?
Well, I understand that the subcommittee was meeting to access the scene right now to determine the bill as we speak. The bill hasn't been voted out yet.
Okay.
So if we put this amendment into the bill, hopefully we'll have to send this bill away from means in order to have the number put in the bill. So I would argue that you keep this bill, this amendment out of this bill, so move this bill to the floor. But the way it means to deal with that in the 5038 that they have before them, it also takes less time to get this bill through the process. This is the House bill and the House side.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, if the subcommittee on Ways and Means and Ways and Means adopts it, there is no need for the statutory authority contained within this amendment?
That was my understanding based on the conversation with Mr. Butler.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Devlin.
What we will do is we're probably all going to vote yes, or I'm going to vote yes ultimately on the floor. The two of us will vote no and create a notice of minority of court so we can verify this report. Comes on Monday, and obviously we may still be voting yes on the floor.
Sure. May I respectfully suggest an alternative procedure, which is
you can give notice of possible reconsideration. I'm not sure if that would save any time. Alternatively, it seems that we can suspend the rules and pull the bill back tomorrow, but if we have a possible minority report pending, it may delay the bill by one day. At this stage of the session, the House bill delayed one day is that much further in distress.
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest another alternative. We have moved a number of other amendments into this bill. If we could just hold up on the final vote to hear from legislative counsel, if this bill is anyway still necessary. Obviously, even if we went forward with this amendment, we'd be passing it on to the same committee that's acting on the same thing. So whatever decision they're going to make, whatever issue is going to be made, so if we could just hold it up for a few minutes to see if there's any necessity.
You're apparently working on it. It would be probably in our best interest just to recess the work session on this bill and perhaps send back to it later today. And it's not my intention to send this down the way to me.
Okay. If that would help, I'd be.
Pardon me?
You'd have to if you put this amendment in it.
Is that noted?
If it has a blank dollar amount. They're the only ones who write the dollar for you in. That should be figured into the budget.
Okay. And in the next hour, we can clarify whether or not we need the statutory organization to do what they're doing anyway. If we don't, we don't need the amendment.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is it is the identical language.
Okay.
In ways and means of this, you do not need statutory authority twice.
Yes, sir.
Right. No.
Yes. Have we already adopted the amendments we wanted? I just wanted to double check. I had written down three as adopted. I think we're pausing then and
we're pausing. So if we are adopted.
On the verge of a motion to send out.
57s and 4s have been adopted.
Thank you.
We will recess and the work session on after 38.
You can kill my wrestler.
Yeah.
I'll kill the wrestler.
Yeah.
I'll kill the wrestler 8 months too, I know.
Yeah.
Not at all. Is that a little wholesome sport?
I have the most in public health.
You're the wrestler.
Yeah. Hey. You're the voted no.
I don't know.
Review for us if you would what we're doing with this, and maybe to some members the keep you put together.
HR 67-1 amendments. You have a copy of the amendments. You have a background speaking to what the individual problems are in the Constitution related to redistricting, and another copy of the timeline that was discussed at the June 30th meeting on the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman.
Again, changes some of the deadlines in the Constitution for redistricting. It doesn't change any deadlines in the left-hand column if the legislature enacts a plan by July 1st of 2001, but does change dates if the legislature fails to enact a plan and the legislative plan goes to the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Manning.
Are we in work session?
We are.
I move adoption of the Dash 1 Amendment by Chair 67.
Colleagues have a motion before us to adopt the Dash 1 Amendment, HR 67.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Manning.
We had some testimony about this, and I was impressed with the added efficiency that this is going to add to the system. It also cleans up the disparity or the problem with a senator being displaced from representing your old district in the middle of your term, even though the second half of your term, you're suddenly representing people that never elected you in. I thought that was strange, so I'm glad to see.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I want to make it clear that that will still happen to holdover senators. This doesn't. A holdover senator that was in the middle of their term will still have to be assigned to a new district.
I didn't realize that. I thought we'd clean that up in here.
What this cleans up is having to assign everyone to a new district.
Okay.
All 90 members to a new district.
But the holdovers do have to be assigned.
The holdover 15 senators will always, after redistricting, have to be assigned to a new district.
So we only clean up part of the disparity that has to do with the non-holdover.
Yes, and all the representatives.
Mr. Chairman?
Actually,
that probably reduces possible federal constitutional problems, I suppose, if we had someone representing an old district after redistricting. So we avoid that problem. But we address part of the problem where there's no real constitutional issue. We leave the other problem perhaps for another day. I could see a lawsuit about that. So. Although this didn't take me as far as my imagination thought it did, I think we're still okay. So,
Mr. Blair,
I want to point out to President Mannix that is only a problem for those 15 senators if they are drawn out of their own district.
Right. So we've minimized it pretty much.
I think so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, even if they still are in a district, their address is still in a district that will probably have been changed, so they still need to be assigned. And sometimes there will be two in one district in a new district, or a district that doesn't have a senator. I didn't comment from there.
Mr. Chairman, I think also we should weigh the fact that the districts are being drawn after the next census for the purpose of serving the citizens for an entire decade. Given the population growth factors that we've had over the last 10 years, there have been some fairly massive changes in district boundaries. So, I know it's an unfortunate circumstance, but I would anticipate we're going to have at least a few senators here going to be representing areas where they don't live. But the alternative is to draw them to districts in areas that may not actually designate the other needs which are supposed to be addressing under redistricting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an unrelated point. One of the changes that's made is to say that, take out the word regular right at the beginning of the resolution so that redistricting could occur in a special session. The main time that would be important is if you move to an annual session situation and have a limited number of days for the odd numbered year. If the annual session bill would take effect next session, you would have to adjourn by the first week in May, the end of the first week in May, and that would shorten the amount of time, June, and that would shorten by 3 weeks the amount of time you have to do the redistricting because you have until July 1st in the Constitution. If you don't do an annual session bill, it may not be necessary to change this first time of the resolution. And in fact, it might make people think, because the July 1st is kind of buried and this is right up at the beginning, that you're giving yourself more time to do redistricting, which is not the case, but it might appear that it's that way to people looking at the resolution for the first time. So that's just a consideration.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it's in there.
I appreciate that, but I think that's probably an esoteric point that only a very small percentage of the voters would pay attention to. And as long as we get across the message that we're just trying to make redistricting more efficient and more timely, I think we'll be okay.
Mr. Chair, the amendment does not show the election date that this resolution would be on the ballot. It doesn't delete the date on the original bill, which is the general election 2000,
the regular
general election.
Okay, colleagues, the motion, yes,
Mr. Byer? Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out that after our first hand, the administration and I were looking to try to figure out where we deleted that section, and it is right at the very start, in paragraph 1, it's not in public of the bill, by deleting section 7, article 4, is where you get rid of the part about the senators being visiting partial counties.
Okay. So the motion to move the gas on everything to the bill. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Within that.
I move that we send HR 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Positive motion to move HR 67 as amended before the due pass recommendation. Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Mr. Devon will be the carrier. There's more amendments to 1181. This is Star has been in Sydney. You're going down the way from me.
Okay.
Yes, sir. This is Star down the way from me, too. I think the reference Williams also here. I work on some amendments to 1181. And we'll go on to 722. This is the administrator for 722. I think Peter is in. Okay. Our staff is coming back. and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 722. We have a series of amendments before us, and
make sure we have to go through something before we have it.
Yeah, we have
8, 9, 11, 13,
and then Representative Edwards has -14.
I need to be.
Chairman, and there's 17 in your packet.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I do. Since so long, Mr. Chair.
I don't have any of those. I've only got 16.
Representative Montgomery has 17.
And 17's in your package. Right. In your
package. I don't have any 10s, 17s, or...
I don't know. Well, perhaps we should... go on to something else. My staff will make copies. I have 16s, and I have... Request of Anthony, I believe. All right. Head nods in the back row. That's right.
I don't have a copy of the scans. I have seen them on you, though. They're gut stuff.
I have an extra copy of 13.
We have 13.
I don't have that. You have an interest in the 8 and the 9, I believe.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Grant Insurance, representing the Oregon University System. The A8 and 9, A8 is the effective, is the substantive amendment. The 9 is a housekeeping one. The 8 simply decoupled the non-PERS option retirement program of the Oregon University System's academic faculty.
Means the
option
for optional retirement that's currently in place.
That is correct. Adoption of the A8 would be to separate them from other changes in the bill. A9 would simply delete reference to a closed option, which is no longer available and does not need to be conformed to other changes in the bill.
Okay. Representative Mannix, do you need the A8 into House Bill 722?
I do.
House Bill 722. Part of the motion for us to move the A8 amendment into Senate Bill 722. Is there any objection? Okay, none. So ordered. Representative Mannix.
I move adoption of the A9 amendment.
Part of the motion to move the A9 amendment into Senate Bill 722. Is there any objection? Okay, none. So ordered. And then we have Maria Keltner. You here? Come up, please.
Go ahead, sir.
The A13.
Maria Keltner representing League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. The A13 amendment makes some technical corrections and changes to the bonding provisions, which would allow local government to enter into a bond to pay for the unfunded liability that they have with PERS. These have been discussed with several bond councils, the Attorney General's office, and the Treasurer's office, and everybody agreed that these were what needed to be done.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Mann,
I move adoption of the A13 amendment.
Clause of motion for us to move the A13 amendment in the Senate Bill 722. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative Mannix.
I request I move that we suspend the rules for purpose of adopting a conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, one of my colleagues volunteered to do this, but I'll do it.
Happy.
I'll do it. We will not be providing the vote to suspend the rules today on this bill.
Okay.
All right, so as I understand it, my Democratic colleagues will not support a motion to suspend the rules.
That's correct.
All right.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
We also have an A12 amendment. It is Sunday.
It is. Yes.
Okay.
I think it's the Treasury Department.
I believe that's correct.
Raleigh, you have the A12.
We'll have to say it's not there.
Chair?
Yes.
Yes, we do. Any questions?
Review for us again the purpose of the function of the A12.
Provide the authority to, Mr. Chair, the Dash 12 provide the authority to...
please introduce yourself for the record.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, excuse me. My cold. For the record, my name is Raleigh Lithrock. I'm Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury. The Dash 12 allow the purchaser to work with local governments to issue bonds to cover their unfunded liability.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Maddox.
I move adoption of the A12 amendment. To my motion?
Yes, to your motion.
Thank you. The A12, I think, will beef up the capability we've talked about in A13 that allows the Treasury Department to equip. I understand it.
The colleagues have a motion to move the A12 amendment into Senate Bill 722. Any objections?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Byer.
Before we vote, I'm curious to know how, since how the A12 and A13 both change the same section, are they going to meld together into one section, or will the A13 actually surpass the A12?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Matt.
If we're sending these out at the same time in the same bill, the legislative council will then, when they blend them together, will make them copacetic. But it is the intent of this motion that they be copacetic. That one not supersede the other.
Thank you. They complement one another, not serve in conflict with one another. And that's correct. The legislative council will be able to iron out
as long as we have that clear that they will both be in there, not one instead of the other.
Okay. Any objections? Moving the A12 and the Senate Bill 722. Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
President Mannix.
Thank you. I move adoption of the A17 amendment.
That was brought forward at the request of Representative Montgomery.
Yes.
Do you have an explanation about this machine? Can you give us an overview of the A-17, please?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the A-17 amendments bring into effect
the governmental subdivisions that were excluded from the tax exemption of this purchase included in prior legislation by the body in another session, past session. When it comes to taxation, if you look on page 2 of the amendment, it defines going back to October 1, 1991, the term multiple for amount of non-purchase. This is those government entities where people look to the government but are not part of PERS. Therefore, they were not included in the last time that what they should pass for a session about excluding the tax. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
Clarification, then this would be such entities as the Amalgamated Transportation Union, Portland Firefighters.
Well, they were, the Portland Firefighters and people already included in that. But we're talking about small towns like maybe I can't remember specific towns right now, but small cities that are not in the first. There's about 100 of them, I think. And that's about 5% of government employees in the state.
Okay. The question here is just what's their current status?
They're not included.
Mr. Chairman, didn't
when it comes to the tax exemption on the income tax of extension.
But do we know if any similar adjustments have been made in their compensation based on
no.
the court decision?
No, they were not part of that. The court decision is made on the first employee.
Mr. Chairman, can we ask if any of the local government entities that are here are aware of this amendment and if they have any position on this amendment?
Oh.
Maria Keltner, representing League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon County. This is the first I've seen of this amendment or heard of it. In response to one of your questions, I know there are a number of local governments, including cities and counties, that do have non-PERS plans, and my understanding is that they treated the taxation issue in various ways in terms of compensating their employees. I don't have any hard data. I didn't have a chance to correct any.
Mr. Chairman, since it's clear this bill's going to have to come back to us in a day, could we have a day to find out more information about this?
Well, it's not clear, but thank you that we will have to conduct this. At this point, so we could move to the court today.
Thank you.
So, are you happy just to suspend the lease for a little bit?
Mr. Chairman.
Or suspend the
Mr. Chairman, do we have a revenue impact statement for this amendment?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
I didn't realize that the Representative Montgomery had not yet provided this amendment to some folks. The idea was really an equity issue as to deduction, subtraction from federal taxable income as to certain retirement pay received under non-PERS pension income in the past. But it is a significant piece of this, and I if we don't have a revenue impact statement, then I'd assume withdraw the motion and say it's too late.
Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily object to the inclusion of the amendment. I just ask for clarification. And
this is Bill.
This is Bill. Without the author of the amendment here to speak to them, and the local governments haven't seen them, I haven't heard that we're under threat of suit or anything from local governments or their employees dealing with their first hand and whether they're taxable or not. I would just assume not include them at this point in time.
There's, of course, some citizens who had contacted first and also contacted the governor's office, and they were told to contact the legislature if they were interested in changing anything related to this issue.
Mr. Chairman,
this kind of stuff, though, it does come up every session, and it can be brought up in a timely fashion and another time and place, either
in the next couple of days somewhere else, but I don't think it needs to be added to this bill. I had assumed that this information had been shared when I made the motion. So again, unless there's an objection, I just can withdraw the motion.
And it could be considered again in conference committee, I guess.
Yes.
So, okay, if you will move to withdraw the motion to adopt the A-17 victory mask, I would accept that motion.
Pardon me?
You do then move to withdraw the A-17.
Yes.
Okay.
And I have no further amendments to offer. I don't know if anyone else.
There were some, we had some earlier discussion of sideboards around the opt-out, and several sets of amendments were drafted relevant to that. And we have had some discussion of the third tier. Is Representative Starr still required down waiting means?
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, if you're still on work, I would just like to put a statement on the record, I guess. I think the first year is an important part of this bill. I understand the realities about moving a bill that, and being voted. I would support that. If that doesn't happen, I think that this is an issue that definitely needs to be studied in the interim. I don't think the Speaker necessarily needs to appoint a special committee to do so, but I think that one of the existing interim committees that will be up and running should probably take this on as a project to look at the entire sewer system, the third tier, the opt-out, and to see, you know, the local government issue and maybe make it a study for an interim committee.
I personally like the third tier. Personally, I think it's needed. And I'd like to ask Mr. McAllister, Mike, to come up and visit with us about this a little bit and the effects of the third tier, what it could do for local government and the situation local government find itself in with the current system, and give us some overview of the benefits they see that could come from keeping the bill as it is, or and whether that currently. Would you please, Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mike McArthur, Sherman County Judge and President of the Association of Oregon Counties. The association is currently in support of 722 with the third tier. This is, as a bit of context, I'd like to give you an example of what's happened in Sherman County as a result of the changes in PERS. We learned that our rate increase from this fiscal year to next fiscal year is going to be 6%. That is 8% to 14%, which is 75% actual increase in the PERS rate. As a result of that, and based on the revenues that were available to the county, our employees are working this year with no cost of living adjustment in order to maintain the level of services that we have in Sherman County. When we looked into this and met with PERS, we found that our current unfunded liability with PERS is 25% of 1 year's payroll.
So that's in your county?
Yeah, to catch up right now so that our employer accounts were even with our employee accounts would take 25% of 1 year's payroll for our county to catch up.
That's a result of market performance?
It's a result of several factors, the biggest being the biggest single factor probably being the difference in variable and fixed. The second biggest factor being 3349 and the legislation that paid back the other retirees and our share of that. Our long-term unfunded liability is estimated right now at 75% of 1 year's payroll for our county. So, and I understand the way that's calculated, it's still 2 years ago is when that calculation was based on. So it is a very good chance, from my understanding of listening to what's been happening, particularly watching what's happened to the market, that is going to be greater in the future. In other words, it's a very good chance that our rates will increase more as a result of the next actuarial evaluation. So it's having a very negative impact on us as a local government. So we badly need several different fixes. We've looked at the 722, and actually we're providing a letter to you here today from Maria Keltner of Local Government Institute that has
analysis by an actuarial of this legislation. And what was asked is, one of the questions was, can Tier 2 be fixed and stabilized so that it would eliminate the problems that local governments face? And what the actuary determines is that there's a residual volatility that is very difficult to fix. And it outlines about 7 different things that need to be done to stabilize Tier 2. But even having done that, even if you could accomplish all those things, there would still be a problem of variable rate. And in order to keep up, because I don't want to get too detailed into this explanation, because I get lost pretty quickly too, but because there are 2 different systems, money match and full formula, you have to constantly adjust the rates depending on which one is being used. And currently there's a 2-year actuarial evaluation. That would have to be much faster, and the rates that employers would pay would have to be adjusted frequently. And there's no predictability there. So it's very difficult for us to budget as a local government. What we're looking for is some predictability and stability. We don't have the luxury that the state has of the increasing income taxes to provide the money that you have to provide to state employees in education. As I stand for education loans, about $80 million this year to cover the first increases. For instance, our local government's growing at about 4%. So it's difficult for us to budget for those types of differences in predictability. As much as we'd like to have an attractive retirement program, what's important to us is that we have one that we can afford and one that we can count on. So for those reasons, we think that the stability offered by Tier 3 is necessary this time. And if you have any detailed questions, I'd refer to Maria.
Okay. So over time, the Tier 3 could make a lot of difference for you. Apparently, new employees can run on Tier 2. And how much of the current unfunded mandate that you're facing is a result of the initial tier, and how much of it is a result of the second tier? Well, that's a detailed question you might not be prepared to answer at the moment, but can you estimate ballpark figures?
Chair Simmons, we don't have that breakdown. I'm not even sure if PERV actuary has broken that down between Tier 1 and Tier 2, but I'd defer to PERV on that.
Okay. And over time, what benefit do you see the third tier providing to local government?
Mr. Chair, the predictability of being able to budget for a fixed rate. And let me go back to what the actuary said. In order to have stability in Tier 2, you need to have your unfunded liability 100% funded, because that gets away from you with the earnings that the investment council has turned over to PERS. So if you don't keep up, if you don't keep your unfunded liability up, and you constantly have to be adjusting the rate in order to keep up, you have to constantly adjust the rate. So you need to stay at that 100% match level with the employee over time in order to keep Tier 2 from getting away from you as a liability. So what Tier 3 does is it defines what the local contribution will be and essentially makes it predictable.
Okay. Within a minute.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 722 as amended to the floor. Will it be passed?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
In accordance with Rule 14 of the rules for the committee, you have to have a current revenue impact statement to have to go out to have a revenue impact. I don't see a current revenue statement.
We'll send it easy.
9 and 8. 8, yeah.
Yes. Okay. I think we had a motion, then we had an objection.
Mr. Chairman, we do not have any objections on the bill of not having a current
subsequent revenue statement, and we will not object based on a fiscal statement.
Are we discussing the motion, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we are. Is that the motion? To make the bill before the House to do pass recommendation. Yes, Rep. May.
I think that this bill is in some danger of not passing on the House floor in the condition it's presently put together, but apparently some people want to take that risk. But I'm also committing to moving the process here, and it's becoming increasingly apparent to me that we're not going to end up resolving some of the final issues on this bill in this committee. I was prepared to conceptually amend the bill to take out the third tier language, which is, of course, bothering the most, or see if we could do the A10 amendments that we have problems with that as to some other agreement. So we're stuck with a flawed bill, and the question is, how do we get us off dead center? And I'm convinced the way to get us off dead center is to move the bill out of the committee and send it to the floor and see whether or not there's enough votes to pass it on the floor. If they're not, we'll certainly know where we are.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manning. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
We all know that the basic process for a bill having to pass through both chambers and having to ultimately be signed by the governor. And we all know that there's one way to get a bill that's going to be probably signed by the governor, and it's not the bill that's going to the floor.
Well, I would differ from both my colleagues. I think once people have a thorough grasp of the issue here, that we would have more than enough votes on the floor of the House to move this bill to the governor. And ongoing discussion there, I believe that we will find the governor signing a bill of some form that relates to this very issue. And I think it's time to move ahead. Having said that, would clerk please call the roll?
Representative Potter?
Aye.
No, and serve notice of a minority report.
No, and I join with my colleague on the minority report.
Thank you.
No order.
Aye.
Aye. And Bill 7.2 is before the House to do pass recommendation. I will carry the bill. Can we just close the work session on Senate Bill 7.2? Open a work session on Senate Bill 7.3. And are you happy for
7.3? Okay.
Mr. Chair, are there any friendly amendments to this bill?
Neither are. And the book
my bill section, my after.
So what are we doing in 7.3?
Ruth, please give us an update on Senate Bill 7.3.
Chair, committee members, or Senate Bill 7.3A is before you for the second time. You heard public testimony at your last meeting. The bill modifies the membership of the Public Employees Retirement Board by increasing the number of public employees and decreasing the number of public employees and elected official members.
Thank you, Pat. Mr. Byard, you move that Jane Grove Central 7.3 to move before the House to do that recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that as soon as I ask the question.
Thank you.
Okay.
I have in my notes that after our first meeting on the bill that there was a request that we delete the last sentence of line 12 and all of line 13 of the first page of the bill, speaking about the people, the public members having an experience and invest in their pension management. And I was curious to know if there was a printed amendment.
In response to that, I think that the testimony over interpreted that provision in the bill. I think the provision in the bill was actually written loosely enough so that if I may borrow Representative Edwards' copy, because mine doesn't have to be in front of me right now. It's page 1, lines
12 and 13.
11 and 12.
The phraseology is must have some experience in investing or pension management. It's stated in the disjunctive, so it's one or the other. And experience in investing could consist of having bought a stock in Kmart 20 years ago.
Mr. Chair, with that explanation, and I agree, I would move Senate Bill 723 and version to the floor to do past recommendations.
Mr. Edwards.
Well, that analysis makes this even more troubling. I doubt that's the intent of the language, quite frankly. But I'll say one thing. I don't see why we're doing this. The board's worked well. Why we see a need to change that. Despite the testimony we heard here by proponents of this, the first board served the state well, and I don't see what's broken here. So, if it ain't broke, why try to fix it? Something that doesn't, in my mind, make it any better.
Well, to that I would say that Representative Edwards, I appreciate that, but that if we make the change and things continue to go as they are, then time will tell, and it will not have been a negative change or a positive change to the first board.
Mr. Tricker, following up, just with you. The only thing is as I got on testimony, first board, it's us, we're the ones who set the rates. If we're somehow trying to get at the system, obviously we just passed another bill that deals with that. I'm not sure what this is accomplishing. Again, the board oversees the management of the fund. The OIC, or the investment itself, oversees the investment of the money. But we're the ones that set the general overall policy of that program. So I'm not sure, again, I come back to you, what by changing the composition, what ultimately you're going to achieve, a system that does what. So I never saw a problem, and I still think I can pretend that there is no problem, and changing this doesn't make any sense to me at this time at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, I totally agree with Representative Edwards, and I believe that it's in the public sector and the private sector, having an equal number of both employer and employee members on a board works well. I'm part of a pension plan outside of this building that is an equal number of both. They all have a fiduciary responsibility. The bottom line is that they are charged with making sure that that system is solvent. I don't think we're accomplishing anything with this other than just removing employee members of the board, and I don't see any compelling reason whatsoever to do it.
Thank you very much, Mr. McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would disagree that it doesn't work and we fix it. Our first system is in trouble. If we don't do some drastic things to it, it'll break the state. They've done a great job of managing the money, but it's at the expense of the state right now. We have to make sure we take the steps to do that, and this is just one of the steps I think that needs to be taken to make sure that our first system stays solvent and does not end up bankrupt in the state eventually.
It's in the car.
Well, I can agree and disagree with lots that's been said by members on this. I don't think that the fact that the PERS is in trouble is the responsibility of the PERS board. And the testimony that we've had is that whether you're a public member or you're a PERS board member that participates in PERS, all of them have the same fiduciary responsibility. The testimony that we had was that if you look at the votes that are taking place, you couldn't tell a public employee member or a private sector member, you couldn't tell which were which. Well, that was just the comments that I have on this. I'll support the chair and moving this to the floor. I'm just not completely convinced.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. May?
Mr. Chairman, I'm ambivalent about the bill, but I do see that some benefit could come from having persons with some investment and some expertise in management, even though I pointed out that it's not a rigid requirement. I have a feeling that the seasoned folks will see some folks brought in who do have some of that expertise, and I think that kind of leveraging of expertise can be helpful to the system. I don't think that this is the dramatic change that will make all the difference in the world, but I do think it brings in some additional insight, and with caution, I'll vote for this at this time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the support, Colin. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, just a comment to Representative Beyer. I think the issue about the fund, I mean, I think a lot of the concern that has been raised about PERS itself, as was described in 722 and that fix, as some are ascribing, you know, we've had some extremely good times with the returns, and that has nothing to do with this board. So, there's no connection. And so that's where I still don't see this change doing much of anything, and don't see a need. Now, I come back to the fiduciary responsibility is broad-based. So by law, everybody that sits on this board, regardless of their biases, has to fulfill that responsibility. And those responsibilities are drawn from the laws which we create. So again, I just see this as is unnecessary.
Thank you very much. The clerk, please call the roll.
President Beyer?
Aye.
President Kevlin?
No.
President Edwards?
Nope.
President Berger?
No.
President Manning?
Aye.
President Starr?
Aye.
President Churchill?
Aye. Mr. Chair, notice of intent of a possible minority report.
Mr. Chair, I'll call in Representative Gardner.
If you notice the record and the motion carries, we'll go to the floor of the House to pass recommendation. Representative Beyer will be the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 7.3, and we'll stand at ease. After order, reopen the extended work session we were in earlier on House Bill 2938. And we had a pending motion to adopt the dash 5.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe the motion had actually been made, has it?
Okay.
We had not adopted the dash 5, and we had not made the motion.
And we didn't have a motion, or did we did not have a motion?
We did not have a motion.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's been the satisfaction of the members of the committee that the dash 5s are being taken care of elsewhere. And so we need to just move the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mann.
I move House Bill 2938 as amended to the floor with a group pass.
Colleagues have a motion to move House Bill 2938 as amended to the floor of the House to do a pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And everybody has a little bit of something in this bill. I close the work session on 2938, and we will go now to Senate Bill 1304. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1304.
I think this is a bill that came from the senior star in the Senate. Right?
Yes.
The jury bill. Just a little history, colleagues. We had a woman from my dad's district, actually not in my district, but lived in Hillsboro, I believe, that was taking care of a child. She was in the nursing stage of taking care of a baby. Got a jury duty notice and took her baby to the courthouse to see, hey, I got this baby I got to take care of. And the judge, actually it was the second time that she had asked for an excuse to be not to serve. The judge wouldn't give her an excuse the second time after the first time. So she contacted Senator Starr and said, what can we do? And that's still the result of that. After some pressure, the judge did go ahead and give the woman a
excused absence or letter off jury duty. That's where this bill comes from. I think it's an appropriate response that you have minor children you're trying to take care of, and you're the sole provider of those children, that you'd be excused from jury duty.
For the purposes of this bill, that would mean a child under 6 years of age.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
Mr. Nick.
I saw this come up on the agenda today, so I haven't had a chance to give anybody a heads up, but it seems to me that this bill provides us with an opportunity to deal perhaps short-term with the problem described by Senator Starr, which could be done through this bill. But in the long term, the real solution is not to continue to excuse people from jury service, but to provide for the jury's expenses, including daycare. We have two bills which are sitting in Ways and Means and which are comatose, if not moribund, Senate Bill 17 and Senate Bill 62, which were comprehensive worked up by the Senate Judiciary Committee to provide for the provision of expenses and including daycare and the like for jurors. I can understand why we can't afford to move them for this particular biennium, but an idea that strikes me is that we could add these to this bill to be effective July 1, 2001 as a long-term solution and have this bill stay in effect, say, till January 1, 2002 for some overlap as a short-term solution. Long-term, for 10 years I've been watching bills be filed about helping jurors with their expenses and daycare and this sort of thing, and I've been watching them put off because we can't afford them, because they weren't planned in the budget. If this is planned in the budget proposals that the governor makes and the legislature works on for the next biennium, then it'll be taken care of. But I'm concerned about juror equity, not just in the situation described by Representative Starr, but folks who have to, we always hear that people's pay is taken care of. That's only true if you work for a larger company or the government, or if you have a collective bargaining agreement, sometimes that covers you. But the majority of citizens work for smaller companies where when they get on juries, they aren't compensated. They get $5 or $7 a day for stipend and a thank you very much. One of the Senate bills allowed for the payment of expenses, including daycare. The other said that after 2 days of being you get, I guess it's $10 that you get for the first 2 days, but after that you would get 8 times the hourly minimum wage as your stipend, which is set off, for instance, if you're getting other benefits and the like. Now, I realize the committee members don't have those bills in front of them. I'm just presenting these ideas for the moment, thinking, if we had a few minutes this afternoon for me to get copies of these bills and have you look at them, we could always say, look, why don't we add these for later implementation so we can take care of some across-the-board issues for jurors, but also adopt this bill in the short term. And I wouldn't even suggest necessarily a cutoff date for what's in the bill right now. We could respect the concerns of Ways and Means. Don't spend the money right now. We could ask them to send over the fiscal impact statements that they have over there so we'll know what we'll do in the future. And if this is just too wild or wacky an idea, I can appreciate that too, but this is a one-shot, and I just saw it come up again on the agenda for today to raise the issue. All of us always say we want to take care of jurors, and it always ends up on the back row in the Ways and Means Committee. And I say that having served since 89, issues come up every biennium. That was a long speech, Mr. Chairman, but I was going to try to make some comments before we got to it today, and I haven't had a chance to tell anybody, so I thought I'd say it all at once in public.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the benefit of that. And I believe there is some validity there to kind of make it equitable for those who sacrifice and take time away from their homes and families and jobs and other responsibilities that they have to serve on juries. And it is appropriate that we begin to recognize that, the sacrifice that truly is in some way.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman?
What if I ran down to legislative fiscal and got the fiscals on these? So not for this plan, because looked at a delayed implementation date and got copies of these bills for the members Or if the members tell me, come on, Representative Manix, enough's enough. But with a delayed implementation date, we could make a nice positive change for the future.
Of course, we have to have some agreement from our fellow committee members on the extension of rules for something like that. So.
The one caveat, Mr. Chair,
yes.
If we can handle it, I think, is that a nursing mother, I think, in any case, should be used from jury duty.
Mr. Chairman, we would leave in the provision that the President starts talking about.
Well, we have the discussion. We will temporarily then suspend the work session.
Can I just ask you one question, Representative Maddox? I mean, in my experience in Multnomah County Court, I know probably 8 or 10 years ago, one of the questions they asked me when I was excused from a jury was whether, in fact, my employer picked up my full pay or not. And at that time, the answer was no, and they accepted that as a reason for being excused. I'm just curious if you know how many counties have that as a rule.
Mr. Chairman, as counties are moving towards shorter terms of service, they're refusing to accept those as excuses now. They are trying to have a juror serve only for one trial, but the trial could last for a month, too. It could also last a day. So they're trying to be equitable that way, but the other side of the coin is they're accepting less, including nursing mothers, apparently, they're accepting less and less of the reasons for not serving the hardship exception. But the other side of the coin is the counties that are getting in line with a new approach do insist then that you will be assigned to your trial unless the trial settles.
And I think something we need to bear in mind in this kind of discussion is that if it begins to cost $100 to $110 a day or more to keep a jury, each per juror in the jury pool, it's going to make litigation much more expensive and could have a chilling effect on the number of people who are willing to. That's a two-edged sword, it cuts both ways. But
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
yes.
And I wouldn't just bring these bills as things that have been filed. These were fully worked up by Senate Judiciary and then sent to Ways and Means, just as our House Judiciary criminal law sent some bills in. So that increases my comfort level about.
If I had any concern, would be putting another mandate on future legislature, but also how local governments would afford this. And I don't know if only the state would fund it all. So. There's a side of me that's, and if I can put this on the record, but what the heck. You know, I guess serving on a jury is part of our system, and it does have a cost, and yet I'd say that's part of being a citizen is you bear a cost on that. Not maybe as much, and I'm not, there may be some limitations to that. I'm not, but as a principle, if it's just purely a cost problem, I guess I'm a little concerned that we would say, well, you shouldn't have any cost to do this. I don't think that's what you're suggesting, but there's a side of me that's just suggesting that the jury service, the jury duty is just a part of being a citizen. It should be something that we may have to incur personally, not cost, not that it should be a complete free ride. I guess and maybe the germaneness of that statement is they're unable to afford daycare. I don't know what the cost of that might be. Are we starting to pick up a babysitter? I don't, you know, I'm just suggesting I don't. Maybe on daycare, I guess, you know, it's like $50 a day or more. It's just too fodder.
If we're going to consider these other bills, we can have this discussion when we get them up before us. And it's something I will be very careful about, I want you to know. But we can have that discussion rather than have it twice. If you want to bring those up and we'll talk about it, maybe you can kind of successful minutes, we can do that at that time.
Okay, I'm going to go out and get the information.
Okay, we will then suspend the work session on 1304 and go to a work session on Senate Bill 1168. And Representative Manix, I think you have some interest in Senate Bill 1168 also.
Colleagues, I have I'm going to have suspension of the rules. We do have health state amendments, but they're to another bill that we want to incorporate into 1168. I'm also going to give you a little chart and a cheat sheet, a little bit of history on Health 2494.
Oh.
Oh, that's good. From animals to people.
This is going to be the kumbaya girl, Mr. Chairman.
And I think this 2494 ended up, we worked this in the House Judiciary, and then we went to the Senate in Rangers.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, they moved the bill out, and it still hasn't made it through the Senate floor. But in the process of doing so, they changed one of the provisions dealing with Measure 11, the Manslaughter 2, if you look at it, requires 20 votes on the Senate floor and 40 votes on the House floor. And we're concerned that we can achieve that level of support. And if not, we'd have to go to conference committee to deal with the changes the Senate made. All of that said, we're coming to the end of the session, where time is of the essence. And we have a Senate bill that we'd have to go back for concurrence if we would move it to the House floor. We believe we have what I would consider the...
The definitive compromise.
The compromise amendment that we'd hope that this committee would support and that the Senate would support and this bill goes back for concurrence. And those are the... I don't have many copies. Did you send us out the amendments to 2494?
Did you have a comprehensive amendment that could be moved into?
Yes, and I thought that I asked them to copy it. It's the D19 amendments to House Bill 2494.
And for my information, where is it still currently in the Senate?
Actually, it's been on the House Senate floor for, I think, 3 days. It's carried over for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
They might get through tomorrow, but they might not.
And so why would they, if they're going to get through it, move the bill?
Well, the problem is the conference committee and the time that it would take to pull a conference committee together, try to work a bill in conference. And coming up to the end of the session, we're concerned that we will run out of time to get that all accomplished. So we want to have another option, and this is another option. It's been what we'd like to do.
Well, last session, we had conference committees meeting on 1 hour notice all night long. Last night we met, but concurrence is going on, and that's what I will allow the committee to entertain the concept.
Representative Mannix will talk about looking on your chart like this. What this amendment to the 19
amendment? I should mention, Mr. Chairman, we weren't planning on a birthday surprise for you today, even though it's not your birthday. I had talked to Representative Starr about some ideas on this. We did meet with Representative Lowe because she's the other representative, and she actually supports the compromise package that was put together. We were doing this in anticipation of getting the Senate bill back, or the House bill back, but we're worried that it's been a long time. The question that the concern I'd expressed to Representative Starr, since then we've had discussions about putting the Senate Bill 392A5 amendments into this bill, and that may prove too heavy a weight for the bill to get across the channel. It may go under.
Hmm.
I guess the governor's office. And I'd be worried about putting our face shielding cargo in a bill that... And by the way, Mr. Chair, you should be aware of that too in terms of the
is aware of that, yes.
And I don't want to... I want us to have all the cards on the table. He had a pretty strong suggestion from the governor's counsel that he really didn't like those of the death warrant amendments that would speed up the process.
and he really didn't like those. And, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to just lay it out, but maybe I'd be willing to back off on those if those create too much weight for the vehicle. If we did the dog and cat food piece refined, and we did the face human piece in a compromised package, we'd have a good vehicle here for that. Without a two-thirds vote requirement, which is what the Senate version has now, and I don't think it's got a prayer, if I could say that, on the House floor.
And the B-19 amendments going everywhere here would not have the two-thirds vote requirement.
Would you want to say what to do to look in this chart?
This chart had to do with a comparison of the various versions of the bill as it's gone through various lives. And if I point out the Senate version is what you could focus on right now, as opposed to the House minority version of PAC, these amendments were going to be designed to go along with the Senate in certain areas. And you're going to have to help me because I don't have my marked up version here. So we're retaining the defense for murder by abuse and manslaughter one, just as the Senate did.
Right.
We had repealed it in the House. Frankly, the reason for that is the defense is almost immaterial for those crimes based on the description of those crimes. You can leave it on the books to make some people feel better, and I'm being very blunt about it, but we don't think any prosecutor would ever charge in a true face healing situation under those crimes anyway. As to manslaughter two, we had repealed the defense. The Senate repealed the defense, but then created a special Measure 11 exception, and that's going to require a two-thirds vote. Now, President Starr, do you have a market?
We repealed it. No.
Can we leave that?
Similar that is the B-19.
No. Unless we're trying to
describe it. Following along. So we end up retaining the defense on murder by abuse, retaining the defense on manslaughter one, repealing the defense on manslaughter two, leaving the law as is on criminally negligent homicide, which is what it was generally, one version didn't do that. On criminal mistreatment one, if I recall, we went ahead with repealing the defense for victims 15 and under. And criminal mistreatment two, repealing the defense for victims 15 and under.
Right.
Criminal non-support, we repeal the exemption. Same goes for child abuse, if I recall.
Right.
Which is more the Senate version. So we're going half of the Senate approach and half of the House approach. The idea being those are areas where, particularly child abuse, where you want to be able to be more proactive, and this is when the child is still alive, so you don't want to see that kind of defense. In criminal mistreatment 1 and 2, that's probably the hottest area of controversy. That would allow someone who's an adult to say, look, leave me alone, I want my caregiver just pray over me, and even though there's care available for me, I'm an adult, I'll make that decision. But it says for kids, no, you can't say that. Person who's 15 and under, you would say they do need to receive medical care. Now, we went over this with Representative Lowe Thursday or Friday, and also met with John Horton, who's counsel to the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law, and met with Dale Penn from the District Attorney's Association. All of them are in agreement that, of course, Mr. Horton is simply giving us advice. It's his job to just follow us. The others are in agreement that these pieces work and serve as a compromise between the Senate version and the House version.
I also talked with Senator Crowe, whose bill this is, and he was okay that we would amend this into the bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I'd known this was on the agenda, I would have said something to you yesterday evening.
I appreciate that very much. So what you would suggest then, Representative Starr, is that we take House Bill 2494, add the B-19 amendment, and conceptually amend that bill as amended by the B-19 into Senate Bill 1168.
Correct.
So the remaining classes would work.
And that would be the B and gross version of the bill, which is either amendments to the B and gross, which is the version in front of the Senate now.
As long as no one challenges or name this problem, issue we could be on.
Well, we have a wonderful relating clause here. This still relates to crime, and certainly all of these amendments relate to crime. And I realize relating clause and germaneness are not exactly the same, but here I say relating clause defines the germaneness.
Another convenient point.
Yes.
What you're proposing, for example, understands is that the B and gross of 2494, along with the B-19 amendments to that engrossed bill, be and growth into SB 1168A.
Yes. So this is the essence of the bill, of the,
right.
the various versions we've had before us, both on the House floor and in the House Judiciary Criminal Law Committee. We've spent a lot of time on this piece of legislation, particularly. But I think Representative Mannix, you had some to do with that two-thirds vote required, didn't you, at some point?
Well, we kept trying to avoid that problem.
Mm-hmm. In the past, though, wasn't it one of your...
Measure 11.
Yes.
Measure 10.
Measure 10. It requires a two-thirds vote by the legislature to change sentencing guidelines. Yes. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for clarification. I missed a couple of these. On criminal non-support and child abuse, did you say you repeal religious exemption or repeal the defense?
Repeal the defense.
Okay.
The House majority version.
Then on the criminal negligent homicide, what I didn't catch what you had done there.
There is no defense there, and we leave that alone.
Please. Okay. Mr. Chair.
So I understand as well, the first two categories, murder by abuse and manslaughter one, you still retain the Senate version, retains the defense. Is that clear?
Yes.
And is that, so is, again, I haven't been tracking that bill at all, like you guys, but is that, what we pass is to the right, that column, the Senate
right.
version, and the left is the version before the Senate.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to remember the debate on this. What was on the floor? I mean, what was there?
The main point, if I may, Mr. Chairman, on the murder by abuse and manslaughter one is we questioned whether, when you look at the definition of the crime, nobody who's praying over their sick child could ever have been found guilty of having committed those crimes. It's the way the crimes are defined, which is the prosecutors have said they would never prosecute and they would never get a conviction anyway. So if you leave the defense, it's more symbolic and you're just not touching the issue. And the Senate didn't want to touch the issue, fine. We won't touch it either. We had talked about repealing it because we thought, practically speaking, it wasn't necessary. Manslaughter, too, is more problematic, but we also decided if ultimately a jury is convinced that someone did commit what is manslaughter, too, then let them go ahead and impose that sentence. We think it's more likely that they will almost always end up with criminally negligent homicide, which is a lower-level offense, which is not a Measure 11 offense, and which allows the court more latitude about sentencing. And criminal mistreatment 1 and 2 were both higher probability prosecution situations, and we think the line to be drawn there is to just say, for kids, you don't have the spiritual treatment defense. You've got to get medical treatment because this is, you know, serious physical harm, danger of loss of life. But for someone who's over 15 or over, I guess, over, you know, over 15, and this is what the House has done before, we just say, well, they're old enough to make a decision themselves as to whether or not they want to have medical care.
Mm.
And on the criminal non-support, no one seems to think that we need to have a the defense there. That's overstating a little bit. But, even the proponents of the defense didn't argue very strongly there. Child abuse, there's a lot of debate about that, and our view is that these are situations where you do want the authorities to look into what's happening to these kids.
How would you you're the legal expert here. How would you summarize then this amendment? Is this, I mean, if you encapsulate the whole thing.
It essentially says that faith healing as a defense is severely limited to situations where a very extreme crime has been charged, and it's allowed for adults, where adults are receiving that care and they've made that decision. But basically, up to little kids, if you should have gotten medical care, you should have gotten medical care.
And if I might add, Mr. Chair, as you were aware, Mr. Chair, of being on the committee, testimony before the committee that was that if this legislature were to change this law, that the folks that practice physical treatment would change the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is critical. I for one have no joy in
sending some parents off to jail because they prayed over their kid and their kid were to die. And I said this on the health board when we debated this issue, what I do want, and I want to change the behavior because I want little kids that feel to live. And I think that's what we accomplish when we do this.
Further discussion? Through our work session, Mr. Manx, do you move the day 9 amendment from the Senate Bill 1168?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
And then we'll define what is a dog or a cat.
Yeah.
For purposes of the original bill. Great. Your objections? Hearing none, so ordered. 8-9 amendments are moved into Senate Bill 1168.
Mr. Chair.
President Spar.
I move that we suspend the rules for purposes of successful amendment.
I
don't think I can do that for the
18-19
amendment.
I believe so. Colleagues have a motion before us to request a suspension of the rules for purposes of considering conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 1168. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Director Starr?
Mr. Chair, I would move the House Bill 2494B in gross and the D19 amendments to that bill in debt, Senate Bill 1168.
Colleagues have a motion before President Edwards?
It's just clarification. Is the motion to adopt B-19, not the bill?
Well, I think we have to include the bill.
We have to include it as amended by the B-19 amendment.
Gotcha.
Okay. Further discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman?
The bill is amended. Yes,
I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass.
The positive motion for us to move the bill as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Manning.
First of all, I appreciate the Chair's flexibility and consideration on the pay ceiling issue, and I'm saying for my colleagues. Second of all, in deference to the dog and cat flow concerns, which, by the way, Senator Courtney called me about it at 9:30 this morning.
Okay.
So, I have not offered other amendments that might put a big anchor around the neck of this bill. So I appreciate your consideration, and I think that we'll look to other vehicles as to these death penalty, death warrant amendments.
I just think it's important to get some of these, to move those amendments at some point to legal time to support them. I just think it's a needed change to our sentencing guidelines and the way that the capital punishment process work on appeals after sentencing. So it's not sentencing guidelines, but if you manage.
And if I may explain, I think I have special vehicle identified in another live committee that has a narrower relating clause, but those amendments will fit into that bill, whereas these amendments would not. And I should mention that too, so that the Chair will understand that we have not issued the death penalty for those amendments.
Thank you very much.
If I might just comment on that, as Representative Mannix referred to it as speeding up the process, I wouldn't necessarily refer to it as speeding up the process, it's just allowing a different process to occur concurrently.
Nicely put.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
Okay. Senate Bill 1168 goes to the floor of the House to do pass recommendation. Volunteers for carrier, Senator Starr will be the carrier, and that closes the work session on Senate Bill 1168.
Thank you very much.
I need to go back now, and I need you to post 728. You can move it today. It has to do with the PERS and vote union officials being able to get them back. We've heard the bill.
Hey, it's great. Sausage maker.
We had suspended a work session on 1304. We could finish off the back page on our agenda. We go back to that.
and get 728 posted up. No, okay, let me see. You're right, we did 728. We'll back to an office if that wasn't been related to you just picked off on your list the other day.
He'll cross it out. All right, he knows the envelope.
Let's go back and then deal with our work check on Senate Bill 1301. Representative Manning.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we suspend the rules for purposes of the House and Conceptual Amendments.
Why don't we talk about those amendments first?
Sure. I will draw the motion.
Thank you.
Well, Senate Bill 17 has to do with the rate of expenses that are paid and travel. I think the members now have the Senate bill in front of them.
Were you interested in moving both of these bills into one?
Well, it might be that I'll mention that they both do different things, but one is substantially more expensive than the other.
The rate implementation, we can get push the fiscal out of this financial.
Both, in essence, since I was sworn in January of 1989, I served on judiciary for two terms, then I served on ways and means for two terms, and every term we had the same discussion of, gee, our jurors really aren't being taken care of, gee, let's do something about it later because we can't afford to do it now. And frankly, jurors serve, they get beaten up, and then they step down from serving, and we won't see them again. So there is no juror caucus out there or juror political action committee to come in to say, would you please take care of us? The judiciary is coming routinely trying to get us to address these issues, and God bless them, they do what they can, but it's not like there's an organized group out there. And we do have the state court administrator here. I see that she happens to be in the room, and she could probably do a better job than I could, Mr. Chairman, giving us a synopsis of these bills.
Okay. You care to? Short notice, wander into the hearing here, and then you get called up to testify.
For the record, Kingsley Swift, State Court Administrator. For an important project like this, I'm happy to have short notice. The two bills, as were mentioned, were initiatives of the Judicial Department and the Access to Justice Committee under the Chief Justice. They are to increase the compensation for jurors as well as to allow more flexibility in what you can reimburse jurors for while attending their service. The idea was to reduce hardship in service, which affected who is able to serve, as well as provide more equity in the system. As Representative Mannix mentioned, it's been well over 15 years, maybe 20 years, since these fees were adjusted. The Judicial Department, the Chief Justice, did submit the monetary increases as a budget package in Ways and Means. They weren't acted upon at the time of the Judicial Department's budget, but the two bills remain in Ways and Means that would allow these changes. The impact. Senate Bill 17 provided for increasing the mileage reimbursement and actual costs such as daycare that a juror might suffer. The fiscal impact of the $2.9 million was if you reimburse your mileage at 30 cents a mile based on what we are currently paying in the way of juror mileage. We also had an estimate on how many jurors may need reimbursement of dependent care expenses based on experience to date. Senate Bill 62 had a fiscal of approximately $5.4 million, which was based on raising the juror fees after the second day of service up to the hourly wage times 8 hours of service. There are some savings that Mike, that would contribute to our amount of breath. There is some savings.
Water too, I know.
Not yet, as if I fall over. There are some savings that we would anticipate if we did not have to do a fiscal for budget purposes until the biennium after this, because right now a number of our other courts are coming online this biennium with one day, one trial terms of service. And as our fiscal showed in Lane County, if we get that up and running this biennium, that fiscal impact would reduce about $250,000 off. This Multnomah is in very close to going to one day, one trial, and that would be maybe even $500,000 off the cost of this. So I think that by putting it out one more biennium, then while there still would be a definite general fund cost, that the estimate now would come down from the department, because we would have better turnaround on juror service, and we wouldn't have as many going through that third day of showing up. And Marion County is our benchmark on that, because they've been one day, one trial for the last year, and we've seen considerable change in both the demographics of people showing up, as well as lessening fiscal impact in the jury payment part, even though we have a startup cost that's a little more because of extra postage. That's kind of a long-winded explanation of those.
I have one question. Would this, if we were to pass either one of them, have added cost to the counties in any way, or would the state just follow the sector?
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, I was going to go back and look at that. I was thinking we had just, in our two bills, just limited to the circuit court. The municipal courts and justice courts have a separate section by which they could increase their reimbursements if they wanted to, but our bills do not. 17 is only in the circuit court, and I was going to take a second to look at least, and Senate 62 is only circuit court, so these would only affect the circuit courts or the state courts, not local jurisdiction courts.
Okay.
Gardner.
Sure, just a couple of three quick questions. One is, could passage of these bills in any way deter those circuit courts from going to the one-day, one jury?
Chair Simmons and Representative Gardner. I don't believe so, because the circuit courts are under the Chief Justice's administrative authority, and he is the main person behind helping promote our circuit courts that are state funded to going through this as a kind of customer service sort of project. And in the administrative office, we have technical assistance to help those courts go to that. So I would be interested in what you might think might create that deterrent, but I think we're moving forward with it, and I don't see a deterrent from this.
Well, just basically showing that the state's picking up the expenses, and therefore, you know, be no incentive for them to move to that type of the system.
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner, right now the state does pay the juror expenses. The answer to Representative Starr's was, in the state court system, you have the appellate courts and the tax court, and then you have the circuit courts, and those are all state funded. What's locally funded are the municipal courts and the county justice courts and county courts, and those are not affected. They're not included in these changes. So I don't. Most of them, municipal courts wouldn't. It'd be rare to have more than one day of trial anyway. Some of the justice courts where they have a misdemeanor trial, maybe 2 days. There might be a chance that they would go longer, but it's not usual, at least in our experience, for those types of offenses to have long trials like the felonies or the civil proceedings.
Just a couple more, Mr. Chair. In 17, you talk on line 20, talks about lodging expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we be picking up, other than a sequestered jury, why would you be picking up lodging expenses in this situation?
Chair Simmons, Representative Gardner. And some of our counties' jurors have come more than 100 miles, like a Klamath or Deschutes, where just six, or Valure, where they have the outer boundaries. And right now, a judge on a case-by-case basis can provide an order to to reimburse them for lodging, but it's still kind of like case by case and a city judge order, and this would just make it more flexible for us to set up some what I call administrative procedures that would just say if a juror lives X many miles away and needs to stay overnight, that we would reimburse at the state rate, or we'd be able to make some voucher provisions for them to stay over.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
did I interrupt? Following up on that, my understanding is this applies most in rural Oregon, where jurors have to travel a long distance to get to the court.
I guess I'm too used to going a mile and a half.
Some folks out there in eastern Oregon that might appreciate the chance to stay overnight at the local hotel instead of driving back and forth.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Edwards, maybe Representative Maddox could help us with this, although this was sent, introduced on the Senate on behalf of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. Do you know why there were two bills set up, even though they relate to the same thing? And could you also just give us a little bit of history of you started to touch on it a little bit of the history of the need, I guess, the need to, I mean, what's happening in the jury selection process? I mean, really, is this addressing something? I mean, Representative Starr's notion is something completely different than this. And in some ways, are they in conflict? I guess that's the third question. Many questions there.
No, I've written down. Chair Simmons, Representative Edwards. First reason there were two of the committee that was in the Judicial Department that dealt with these issues, because of the fiscal impact, decided to break them out so there would be choices. And ideally, if none of the mileage or the per diems were able to be changed, maybe we could at least change the language to get flexibility reimbursed in certain hardship cases and just get a little more, permissive language. So they were broken out just because of getting alternatives and because of the fiscal impact. You asked a question about the need, and it had to do with economic hardships, and right now a number of people who request excusal for hardship, mainly due to inability to have their employers pay for them to be away, or they're self-employed, or they're otherwise citizens. The Access Committee of the Judicial Department was interested because young adults and minorities were more likely to have lower income levels, and were also there was a study that was done that showed that was maybe one of the reasons, the lost wages was a big reason why more people sought excusal or maybe refused to answer a summons, and so someone followed up. So it was done, one, to show respect for the level of service, and two, to improve the ability of people to serve, carry out their obligations in a way that wasn't punitive. Because they're being summoned to the court, they have no. Your third question had to do, or maybe it was your second question, to do with did these amendments, since that's the debate, conflict with the original purpose of 1304? I don't believe I do. The Judicial Department had concerns with the original version of 1304 as being overly broad, and that it might exclude people more than. Now we're able, we worked with Ken McDermott and Representative Starrs on various kind of scenarios for amendments. The last ones, we still had some concerns, but we were basically neutral because we think most of the courts now do excuse people in hardship circumstances that were described, and so in reality, it wouldn't create a big difference in its present version. However, we had a philosophical concern still that we hated to start seeing statutory stair-stepping of excuses for this and that. Why is this more compelling than the person has a dependent aged parent for which they need relief? And so we were actually on Friday still in discussions on a possible other amendment that would maybe come at this a different way and just make sure that people who couldn't serve weren't incarcerated if they were held in contempt. And
yes, I mean, clearly we've got two versions of the bill before us. One addresses the wage issue, one addresses the cost issue of lodging, daycare, and other reasonable expenses. And again, not having any background in this area, nor any privy to the any discussion on this bill in the past, is there, does one of these bills address a more immediate need? I mean, they both have a sizable price tag, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Not huge, but I guess I'm, if we were to try to, was there any, I guess the interim committee, did they have any preference? Or is there something more immediate that one of these 17 or 62 addresses that might be for us to choose? I mean, obviously, they ideally maybe adopt both. But the Mannix is the idea. On the other hand, and perhaps you can enlighten us on that. Is there one of these buildings that is a witness for that tends to address a more immediate problem? I don't really know.
Representative Edwards, they both are immediate in the sense of overdue and affecting people's ability to serve. Senate Bill 17 was the first priority of the two bills in the Access Committee because it allowed the flexible language, the permissive language, the kind of subject for our budget funding that we could reimburse for actual costs that got in the way of people being able to serve and allow the mileage to be increased subject to available funding. As I said, the fiscal was based on 30 cents a mile, which is kind of what the state pays employees right now for travel as well. Jurors get 8 cents, and those that have long distances, that's fairly draconian. So 17 in the scheme of things, though, and then if we went to one day, one trial, we'd be lessening hardships overall, but 62 and improving the overall for people who have to be on long service would be an ideal, too. And you may have a preference, Representative Mannix.
Chairman, if I may. Well, actually, my preference is for both of them because they address issues. If you look at the 8 cents per mile, that was probably established in the late 70s or early 80s. And that's the last time we really did something dynamic about zero service. And yes, I will say this, in terms of the negotiations that are going on about the other bill that talks about limiting juries to registered voters and the like, and we'll probably end up compromising on that. Part of the discussion was, how do we get good people from the community to be willing to serve on juries? What's copacetic or what synchronizes with Senator Starr's and Leslie Starr's language in 1304 is that you won't have as many people saying, I just can't serve at all, which is what that bill lets you do. If the court can come and say, can we help you out? Can we help you with your daycare? We want you on the jury. We want young people on the jury, parents of kids. I have to add quickly, though, we do expect some sacrifice here. The first 2 days of jury service, you still serve for $10 a day. It's only if your trial goes to the third day that you start getting, in effect, a decent stipend for the working person. And if, and there's set-offs here, if you are receiving regular wages, then you won't get the benefit of this. This is for the person who's going to lose their income while they're serving on a jury, and that becomes an extreme hardship if the trial runs for a couple of weeks. This is why people try to get out of it. So I guess this is more than an answer. It's more of the equity argument that it always ends up getting shoved to the end of the list because you won't have 50 jurors in this room because by the time they're done and they won't suffer again for a couple of years or maybe never get called again. So it's a sporadic problem, but when people get hit by it, they really get hit hard.
I just think that I would support, you know, whatever, either one or both. I think that what it is, it's the recognition of values that we all place in those folks that sacrifice to serve our jury. And sure, it's a civic duty, and it's, you know, we're part of being an American citizen is serving on juries. But on the other hand, they also do a valuable service and should be compensated as much as is possible for the work that they do. My one concern that if we were to sunset the other bill and try to be
so, back up on that.
Well, I necessarily wouldn't object to all of it, but the one area that I think that should be exempt from serving on the jury at all times is a nursing mother. It makes no sense to me that
that a nursing mother would not be exempt. And the judge in Washington County that brought this thing about was saying, we don't care that you are nursing your baby, and you're going to have to serve. And that was the issue that more than any other that I would like to make sure that we cover in this statute.
What happened to the indigent defense piece you and I worked up? You worked up and you allowed me to put my name on it also.
There are further amendments coming in tomorrow, Mr. Chairman, in Ways and Means. We've been chewing our way through that. The amendments weren't ready Friday. I thought they would be. They're going to end up having, in effect, will be an indigent defense verification program set up. And they also, the proposal is to take Senate Bill 66, which is a reorganization of the courts have proposed, rather than the one that we proposed in our bill, and bring that in. But the time frame for that is over the next 3 years.
And the independent public corporation in the original bill, what happened there?
That would be lost in the process of negotiation and ways and means.
Do the amendments that are going on relevant to that bill, are they going to save the state some money as on indigent defense?
There'll be some savings in this time and because of the verification process. The real savings will kick in then into the next buying. In a way, you could say that if there's a roll up here, the savings in indigent defense will more than counteract it.
I'd be curious to see what the fiscals are.
Well, they've been in the attorney.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is to implement the verification unit, we're going to have to take some funds and hire people to do real verification. And so far, the verification people are like the revenue officers, and you hire them, they actually bring in more than they cost, so it's going to take some time to document them.
So what we're talking about here is $8.5 million cost.
I'm biting my lip.
For buying it. And but if there was some other way that we're making policy changes and choices that would save us some money, then it'd be easier to see. But since it's dark.
$8.5 million and $11 billion of it.
Mr. Chairman, it's $10 million, but he's going to quibble over a couple million. But if the fiscal is just there, relate as the 99-2001 numbers, and it's 3 and 5.5.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
The good news is that these funds would be expended on fair-minded, honest citizens who are taxpayers who are being asked to perform a civic duty. One of the times we're actually spending money on folks who didn't come to us asking for money. We asked them to serve, and we're simply trying to treat them fairly. And I realize it is a cost, Mr. Chairman. I recognize that.
If nothing else, they should be paid at least as well as necessary.
That helps too. You can cut this back a little bit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, earlier, President Maddox started describing this, and I thought he was talking about the legislature, getting people who can afford it, and et cetera. Has any state gone down this path? I mean, is this blue territory?
Kingsley, can you help us with that?
Chair Simmons and Representative Edwards, yes, I think we're in the low end of about 10 states out of all them that still only pay $10 or less. I have the information with me. I just have to find it in the file. We did a survey of the 50 states.
And how does this, can you do the quick math of about $50 a day on the measure 62, excuse me, floor 62?
Yes.
After the third day, how does that stack up against what other states are?
Let's finish the question here.
Chair Simmons, Representative Edwards. I have 10 states pay $5 to 10, 21 states pay $11 to $24 a day, 11 states and the feds pay more than $25 a day, and 8 states plus DC vary, and then I can tell you, I have some information somewhere. There are a few that do the stair step, okay, and I think that's with the states in DC that vary, and I can look up the background information for the camera sheet. it's not unique to in fact, we kind of looked at other states and saw that as a way to kind of reduce the fiscal by going to that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think I would move to suspend the rules to amending the bill for 204.
Well, I would request that members of the committee indulge me. We'll come back to this in the morning.
Okay.
Let it lay overnight. I am sympathetic. I want to digest it a little bit more. And then,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What I'd like is, again, the policy, I think there's a lot of merit. I think, you know, price tag, again, it's all relative, I guess, to other things. There may be ways that we were just talking about, maybe you can adjust Senate Bill 62 for the cost isn't quite so much. And we can, after hearing those figures, we would be on the top end. Well,
after a time of third day.
That's true.
Sure.
But,
you know, Oregon supposedly known for its flying by her own wings and the leading edge of things. And I personally never been called for jury duty. I would appreciate the honor to live on jury. I also recognize the real hardship that it would create to get on a trial that would last more than a day or two as being someone who's self-employed. If I'm not at home working with the criminal legislature, criminal legislature, we do get a per diem that intends to at least cover our expenses for our daily subsistence. It's the least we can do for our jurors. We're going to take the given minimum wage after the second day. I mean, we're going to ask them to two days voluntarily. So if they do a three-day trial, they're going to get approximately $70. You divide that over three, you're down to, you know, less than $25 a day. It's not like it's living high in the hog.
There's a thousand justifications for moving ahead with it.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted a clarification. I was wondering if Representative Byer was worried about his employer not giving him the time off.
His employer may be very struggling right now to give him the time off.
Let me just enlighten me. You know, I've never served at a jury duty. You put my name down. I was talking to people who have, often you get out of jury pool, which you're sitting around and not necessarily chosen, and that can take a few days as well. Is that contemplated, or is it actually you're serving, you're actually a juror? Is that what the bill is anticipating?
So this says, they have required attendance, and I think that part of the deal here would have to be that Chief Justice does continue to move towards the one juror, one trial system, so that you actually aren't even required to attend under that system unless the trial, you come in, and then you really will be there for some time. You check in the night before, there's a phone number you call, and you have a code, and you find out if you have to come in the next day. If you do have to come in there, you better expect to be there all day.
That's endeavor.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the chair's wish and time for waiting until tomorrow. I, too, have never served.
I was a jury foreman.
Yeah. My wife has been called three times. The other thing is the way it's structured, I would think the way it's structured, you would have more courts universally going to the one-day, one-trial system. Because if you can keep people there, if you're only paying them a small amount to serve up to 2 days, it would seem like that would be a very big incentive going to that system universally.
Sure, we'll just recess the work session at 1604 and perhaps come back to it tonight. Okay? Thank you. Where did you come here to testify for today? Are you
You're in town, I watch. Chair Simmons, if I could just briefly answer Representative Carr's concern on the nursing mothers. Under the current bill as amended, since it deals with dependent children and allowing an excuse for the certification, that I believe it covered the scenario that you were concerned with without a further amendment.
No, you only thought it's pretty broad, and if we get these other things in there.
Oh, then you might narrow it.
Yeah, that wouldn't necessarily have to be that broad.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. So we will recess the work session of Chapter 1304, and we will now go back to just briefly, let's open the work session on 1181. Griffin and Starr,
which one?
You've been working on some amendments for 1181. Can you give us an overview of what we can kind of keep up to speed a little bit?
Sure.
And,
I'm out of here. I actually have a little folder on that one. The amendments that I had drafted are the A9 amendments to the bill. And quite honestly, colleagues, what it is, it's the governor's amendments that he provided to the committee with the Section 5 of the A Engrossed Bill, which relates to the Reporting Act. It lists the district to report to the Department of Education and the Senate President and the Speaker of the House. And that's the major difference for that part of the bill. I think that what it does is the reporting mechanism that the governor had, I didn't necessarily like it. Basically, the district reported to itself what it was going to do. And this way, it provides a little bit of accountability that the school district around the state would have to report to the legislature basically why they're spending the money that's going to be above the above the number that's created from the staff and LFO and LRO and the department. The other part of the amendment, you'll find on page 4, the bold section there deals with status quo and negotiations. And changes the definition of the status quo for when collective bargaining takes place for school districts. That was brought forward by Representative Williams as a part of this, and I support that as well. I think it's important that we look at that, and what it does is it gives teachers unions an incentive to come to the table and move quickly to an agreement. In those negotiations, I think it's a little tweak to the collective bargaining issue. They already know what's in it. And I think, quite honestly, that the teachers' unions will likely oppose this part of it, and they've opposed it. And it was originally in 1180, it was taken out of 1180. But it's a minor tweak to the collective bargaining. It's nothing major. I think that what it does is it levels the playing field. Quite simply, and it just means that right now status quo means that teachers still get the step increases, and it doesn't mean what people think it means. And this would mean status quo is really status quo. And I think it's easy to defend, it's easy to explain, and I think it's a compromise that we hope that the governor would consider. I talked with Senator Durfler's staff on this issue. Senator Driftler has agreed that these amendments to 7th Bill 1189 would be acceptable to him. It's a significant move toward a compromise, I think, on what I believe is a pretty important bill this session.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I appreciate the work you're putting into this, Representative Starr, and apologies before you for consideration, and I'll come back to this bill as soon as tomorrow. And get it moving at that time. So, any further amendments you want to introduce?
No.
Not at this point.
Okay, here.
Yes.
We do have the A6 amendment also.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been in the packet. That is an amendment that we're supposed to meet for the administrator, but also includes keeping them not the principal.
Is that the A6s?
The A6s. I believe that's correct. It deletes the reference of 342.8151 and replaces it with 342.120. And that's, I believe that's what that amendment does.
actually staff would.
But you don't need it with this.
With the A9s, you wouldn't need it. Is that right?
As I understand, Mr. Chairman, the original provision had to do with proposing a allowable growth factor. And that offer was made to a specific set of persons, including the administrator. And that administrator, that old definition, did not include the superintendent, and the A6 put them in. This bill, on the other hand, doesn't talk about a allowable growth factor. It simply has to do with whether or not their budget falls within the projected revenue estimates.
Right.
And so it's everybody. It's, I think, books and...
I think it's a much broader approach to this. It doesn't just single out teachers. It doesn't single out, you know, personnel in the, at the district. It includes contracts for busing, contracts for food service as well. You know, if those things put them above the estimates at LRO and LFO and DAS and the part of that gives them, they'd have to say, hey, this is why we're doing what we're doing. This is how we think we're going to pay for it. This is what kind of effect it's going to have on the kids in our district. This is why we think it's important. And I think that having realistic, you know, give us a clue about why they're doing what they're doing, I think is a part of accountability that we're all looking for when 70% of the money is allocated in this building.
Mr. Chairman, this is where I look at Brooklyn Star and have a question about his amendment. If the status quo portion was implemented by a school district, would that also then affect the administrators, superintendents, plus the classified employees, or only be the certified employees?
Somebody that's smarter than me and collective bargaining would have to answer that. My sense is that would not affect superintendents and principals, because my sense is that they have a negotiated salary and not collective bargaining act agreement.
That's my reading of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would be uncomfortable moving down this road if we would be saying that, okay, now teachers, because we've not settled with you, you will have to have the status quo and certified or classified, you're going to have a status quo to be unsettled. But administrators, we can give you raises and step increases and things like that.
Well, they don't have collective bargaining with administrators. There is no status quo. There's no time when the collective bargaining agreement has run out and they're negotiating a new one.
Well, Mr. Chair, my point is that if a school district is going to be doing this for their teachers and their classified employees, and I think it would be classified also, they do have collective bargaining with them. I think the same rules as apply in the current 1181 with the A6 amendment, the same rules would apply to the administration of the district. I think that's important because I think many times, you know, that what's happening on in the administration office of the district is just as important as what's happening with their classified and certified employees.
Okay. I can answer that. They would. If in this bill under the A9, if a school district gave their principal or their superintendent a huge raise that took them above or beyond the revenues that they had available to them, they'd have to tell us why they did that. But they would not be affected, as they are not now currently affected by the status quo part of this, because they just aren't. They're not in the collective bargaining arrangement. So,
but Mr. Chair,
that in there, I don't think
it's possible. My point is this. I know school districts in the past have, at the exact same board meeting where they have cut classified people from their staff, and it, because they, it was said they didn't have enough money in their budget for classified for teachers' aides and for custodians. At the same exact board meeting, they have given their administrators huge raises. Well, in that scenario, the school board could say, look, we're not over our budget, because we have paid our total budget is less than whatever this indicator is, yet in order to do that, they have cut classroom people and beefed up administration. And I would want that addressed. That is not addressed in this region, the way I understand it, but it would be addressed in the original bill.
Further discussion?
Use one for, I think.
and we will then allow some people who have missed opportunities and then have a chance to digest and to put some comments on the record at a later time. And we will close the work session today on Senate Bill 1181. And well, I think if you have a couple more pieces to get to, and we'll recess here for a few minutes, you can get up to your offices and pull 276. Senate Bill 276. Anything else? Pardon me, anything else? I think that's it for right now. We'll select the Public Affairs Committee back to order, and we'll go back to Senate Bill 1304, open session on 1304. And what I would like us to do is have an amendment drafted specifically to 1304 and find some way to put it not at the top, but certainly in a position of compensating our jurors better than we do now. If we could go even to $40 on the third day, it would be significantly further than we are now and a vast improvement. And then some discussion of some lodging expenses certainly seem reasonable as they stand to me.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to have amendments crafted to say $40 from the third day on instead of the...
I'd like to discuss it with members of the committee, Representative Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see amendment drafted that does put a specific dollar value in it, or if we're going to tie it to a minimum wage as this does, to not just say eight times the minimum wage per day, because what...
Per hour.
No.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupted. I'm sorry.
The bill as drafted says that the juror will be paid eight times the minimum wage per day. It doesn't speak to...
Is it per diem for each day served?
Eight times the hourly minimum wage per day.
Right.
So you get paid for 8 hours.
Yes.
I thought you said eight times of a day's worth of minimum wage.
No. But I guess the my point would be that rather than we're going to have a lot of volunteers. Rather than at current minimum wage, that would be $52 a day. Many times jurors only there for an hour or two. I guess I've never been a juror, but I would think that would be the case. So maybe if you're going to tie it to the minimum wage, pay them minimum wage up to 8 hours a day. No more than that. But let's try to make it so someplace Oregon would not be in the lowest state for paying jurors, but probably not the highest either, somewhere in the middle of the road. And also on the lodging and mileage piece, I think that should be tied to a distance. If a person has to travel more than 50 miles, more than 75 miles, more than an hour, you know, somehow, so that Representative Gardner, when he goes a mile and a half to the courthouse, couldn't stay in a Motel 6 halfway between there and get paid for it. So those are the things I'd like to see addressed in amendments, Chairman.
One other thing that we talked about, I wouldn't necessarily oppose sunsetting, and maybe I should talk to Senator Starr before I say this.
Okay,
you don't need to do that. No, I don't need to talk,
No, I'm being... I'm the one who brought up the sunset idea. The more I've looked at this, if we write it right, we don't need to sunset it.
Okay, all I want to on the record is that nursing moms will be covered no matter what you do.
Okay.
Let's just make the mileage rate whatever the federal rate is in terms of whatever it's set at. In terms of IRS code and mileage for normal business travel.
Different IRS code for
travel, right?
The IRS to
IRS code for travel.
There is an IRS a rate that they set.
Yeah.
I think
32 cents. Okay. And I would be...
I may come close to that, but if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr's point would be, we can revisit it in the statute. Of course, obviously,
was kept revisited when it was 8 cents. if you say the federal, then you do have a ratchet effect, although that's less dangerous if you limit the number of miles that are applied.
And you, the federal, Mr. Chairman, the federal has increased over the past 2 years, but it has not increased specifically.
Okay, so we are back to tomorrow.
Oh, I can think of something by tomorrow.
Okay. Good.
We'll close the session on Senate Bill 1304, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 194. And we have new amendments available. It would be the fours and fives.
Yeah,
at my request, Holly.
Which one are you talking about, Mr. Chair?
The fours and fives.
We have those at 85.
We're getting them momentarily.
Okay. Can you give us a interview chat? Have you had time to digest this? Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm a little bit. The Dash 4 amendments say that if the state treasurer's expenses exceed 0.025 basis points, the treasurer shall prepare a written report for the calendar year that describes and summarizes management activities and costs for the year. The report will also contain comparison of treasurer costs with private costs, and the report would be submitted to the governor. After the governor reviews the report, he may request the state treasurer to advertise a request for proposal for management and investment of the fund. The Dash 5 amendment sets the maximum basis points at 0.035, and if the expenses exceed 0.025, the treasurer will prepare basically the same report as under the 4-4 amendment. Plus, the report would also contain an investment summary indicating asset allocation and management costs for each month of the year. That's the difference in the report requirements. The report would be submitted to the governor, the legislative fiscal officer, the e-board, and any other person upon request.
Okay. And I had to ask that these dash fours include that it was in strictly in that report to the e-board and the treasurer and excuse me, the legislative fiscal officer of the e-board and any other person that requests it, and it's not in the dash four.
You want that thing on the
screen? Yeah, so that's that. We'll know where we're at. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Mr. Embiar. Is it your intent that the fives replace the fours, or that are you, both of them would be in, the one in addition to the other?
I've got a few other fold together here, and this is the first time I've had a chance to get to them and just begin digesting the content.
And the amendments, Mr. Chair, would fold together, and then the final amendment that we got would capture that language of the additional people who suggested the question.
If we adopt the fives only, we have a reporting process. If we add the fours, we have the governor's office. Okay, perfect. Okay. Yes, you promised us in
there. No, I'm just ready for it to move the bill unamended.
Chairman?
I don't know if you have the votes to go on amended.
We need to put the energy stuff in there. Yeah.
That's true.
That is
true.
Yeah.
Mr. Mack?
Yeah, no, I had some conversations with Mr. Woodstock, and I'm wondering if the Dash 5 deal with some of the concerns that he had expressed. Because I just got these, and I wanted to see how that fits in. Could I ask Mr. Woodstock?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Raleigh Wishbrock, the Oregon Treasury.
Mr. Wishbrock, have you taken a look at these Dash 5 amendments?
Mr. Chair, yes, I represent them. Yeah.
How do they comport with your concerns that you've expressed about them? Any points on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, we have no problem with Section 8, which is a reporting requirement on this bill, including the addition of the language of who the report would go to that you were concerned with within the Dash 4 to be applied to the Dash 5. Where we have a concern is the cap at 0.35 basis points. It's our great fear that that cap could be exceeded in a volatile interest rate environment. We are getting into that interest rate environment. As you well know, the Fed 3 weeks ago lowered its rates. We lost $500 million out of the fund almost immediately. People were chasing increased profits. We certainly don't blame them for doing so. It's responsible to do that. We think we're that it's quite possible, and you have, I think, in your possession testimony that we had made previously that we show that we could be at a rate of 0.41 basis points for cost in the very near future should we have that kind of volatile environment. I would recommend on the Dash 5 that we keep the 0.5 basis points that will allow us to deal with a broad spectrum of environments and still be able to maintain the fund. That if we had kept it at 0.35 basis points, if we cross that prior to the next legislative session, we would be compelled to shut down the fund.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess the concern I would have would be in regard to just deleting lines 3 and 4 of the Dash 5 amendments. We still have, if I understand, Mr. Wishbrock, the requirement that the 0.25 basis points really be the trigger for taking a look at the what I'll call the competitive forces in the market and whether or not we could do better elsewhere in terms of management fees.
Mr. Chair, we're perfectly amenable to that. As the leading lines 3 and 4.
Thank you, Devin.
Mr. Chairman, the question I have, would 4-5 do it also?
I believe so. It's up a little bit closer, but the projections that we've done, the worst case in the last 4 years, 5 years, would be a 0.41, and that would still give us a little margin. So 0.45 would probably cut it. You know, we're trying to be conservative and have that additional latitude.
Mr. Chairman, if we were going to and the rules and conceptually amend these 4-5 and do only the Dash 5, I think we could probably get near unanimous support on the bill in the committee.
Thank you. Raleigh, in times when you when your management costs exceed the basis points rate of charge, how do you make that up currently?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we are exceeding the charge now. We have combined the two funds. We have the capacity to price them, you know, separately, and neither one of them are exceeding the 0.25 basis points. And we've taken a look in the past, and they have not exceeded the 0.25 basis points. Understand that 1995 we had a different financing system, a different way of accruing costs. So that the scenario that I identified that would take us over the 0.25 basis points preceded the change in how we allocate charges. We allocated charges in the past on the volume of dollars under management, and it was a technical formula that I don't think I can explain to you. I don't have it's not my background, it's not what I do, so I don't think I can explain it in great depth. In the 95-97 session, we realized that we were not charging up to the full capacity of our, up to our full capacity, and nor did we want to charge up to that full capacity. We felt that we could live within a 0.25 basis point cap and suggested that. It was an error. We should not have suggested the 0.25 basis point cap. Representative Tiernan, who was chairing the committee at the time, suggested we should probably have it about 5.5 basis points. He happened to be right, and we were wrong. So historically, we've had the capacity, and those years, and I have some of the data before me, and I think it's been shared with the committee.
I just have to hear that again. Representative Tiernan was right, and you were wrong.
I'm awfully close to metal object, and I would get struck by any lightning, but yes, in fact, he was.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Okay. It's in fact, so. But if I look back at my data, in 1994, we would have exceeded the 0.35 basis points. Probably a couple times in through 1995, and we had the capacity. Subsequent to our making that change in the 95-97, we've never exceeded the 0.25 basis point. And to be very specific, should we ever exceed the 0.25 basis point, you know, we would have to stop LGIP. We cannot, as we've gotten into that discussion, we can't have other parts of the fund underwrite the cost of the local government investment pool. It's a voluntary.
You have, Mr. Lewis-Brock, you didn't have general fund dollars that can be used to deduct the difference.
No. We have no authority. No.
Other dollars that can be used from other sources.
Correct. We have a voluntary fund that benefits local governments, and if the legislature wanted to give general fund dollars out of the budget to underwrite the cost for local governments of assuming those investments, that we could do that, but we can't use the pooled funds. And I think the Attorney General has joined us in the last time we were before you, and it's very clear that, you know, I think my interpretation, I'm not trying to press that interpretation on the Attorney General, it was their interpretation also. So you could allocate general fund dollars to underwrite the pool.
The currently the funds described in ORS 293.701, the last piece of information that I saw that was from your office indicates that's about a $6 billion fund currently.
Mr. Chair, it's in excess of $6 billion. My last figures as of June 99 show at 6.169. I do know that that dropped by $500 million in the last of June, early July. So it's probably, and I'm giving you a gap, it's probably in a range of, you know, 5-8 right now. Where we started crossing the line, we'll cross the line off the top of my head, we'll cross the line at 0.35 when we hit in the $4 billion range. And that's very possible in a volatile interest rate environment. If the Fed starts increasing, bumping the interest rate, we will have an exit from the local government investment pool, but a lot of the people that invest in the local government investment pool will track those dollars, will chase the excess profits that they can get from the increased federal rates. Again, no problem with that, but it drops the size of the pool down, and then that raises our cost per unit up. The cost for managing the pool will stay at about $145,000, but we'll have fewer, you know, accounts to be able to generate the revenue that we need from that. So the percentage of revenue would have to go up. That's when we go up to 4.41 basis points.
Hypothetically. Considerable investigating around the private sector. So you inquire what kind of management costs they would incur to manage the $6 billion fund that is described in ORS 293.701, knowing that there's a lot of money flowing in and out of that fund to local governments and such. And they indicated to me that it could be done consistently for less than 0.25 basis points.
Mr. Chair, I don't doubt that at times it can be done for less than 0.25 basis points. There are times when we only, our costs are less than 2.5 basis points. And we have consistently been under, for since the 95-97 buying, under that rate. The mathematics are very clear that the cost, you know, with a reduced size of funds in a volatile interest rate environment, will go up. The cost per unit will go up. We're comfortable, but I think we address your concern in our agreement on if we leave Section 8 under the dash 5 as it is, that if in fact through our report we find that there is a greater ability for the private sector to manage it at a lesser cost, or even for a portion of it at a lesser cost, it would reduce the overall cost, that we have not only just reports that compels us to look at those costs very, very seriously, but we have our fiduciary responsibility. We have funds in there that we have a fiduciary responsibility for. If we can manage those funds by bringing in partnerships from the private sector or relationships with the private sector and do it at a lesser cost, we are compelled to do that now. That's why we continuously look at what those costs are. When I tell you, and we spoke outside of here, and I said, I doubt if somebody could be our cost in this because we keep a continuous eye on what the private market is doing. If somebody could do it cheaper, or if there's some way of combining our efforts with the private sector effort, we would in fact do so. That's why I embrace what you have under Section 8 in terms of the report. If we find that it's cheaper, we will do it. But all factors have to be the same.
Comment, give me your thoughts on the dashboards.
I have no problem with the dashboards until you get to line 15, and I think we're creating a problem there that we don't need to create. We have a constitutional problem, separation of powers. The Treasurer does not...
Please, Brock, is it your opinion that there will be a constitutional separation of powers issues? Or
yes.
We didn't get that in writing from LC when they produced this for us.
Mr. Chair, we have a problem with it, and we perceive it as a separation of powers issue. The Treasurer is a separate constitutional office. The Treasurer does not work with the governor. We've talked to the governor's office about it and shared our concerns, and it is a major concern with us. We would, you know, strongly oppose this and seek the governor's veto. That's how strongly we feel about it. Though I don't, if you wanted to use the dash fours, I like the dash fours up to line 15. I would amend this if I could do so, and add to the word governor, strike period, put a comma, and say that the reports would also be given to the Legislative Physical Office, e-board, and to anyone else requesting the information, and leave it there. Understand that then goes before, when LFO has it, that's part of our budget review, which is a biennial process. So we only have a two-year span where if, in fact, we were trying to avoid doing what was in the best interest of the fund, which we can't legally do, but you would still have a review before this body on a biennial basis because the reports would be, in fact, in the hands of LFO. And if LFO decided that we should bring that information to the e-board, of course, that's built into the bill.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was given additional information from the Treasurer's office at my request and reviewed it. And at that time, I indicated him I would go out and check and see what's up in the private sector. And I did do that. And in fact, the short-term fund that my business uses is run by our financial institution. And they don't charge any basis points on that. So perhaps maybe the local government should look into some other things. I mean, just you know, the information you're getting for the average is about not 0.25, but actually 3 at this point, 3.0. And, but yet, the one that I'm familiar with my investment, my business works just enough for our short-term fund. So, you know, you keep money in there to make it serve as a checking account, much like this fund does. The local governments, they don't charge any basis points on that. They provide that as a service to their customers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, we can't underwrite the extents of that account as a leader, but I would question whether somebody is providing that service to you for free and not taking the charges someplace else. We can't legally do that.
Mr. Chair,
and in conclusion, the local government.
I guess I'd like to point out, I questioned that also with Associates and said you can't do this for free. And they went and checked with other people and said, no, in fact, they do it. In fact, they are paying higher interest rates than what your information you gave me that you are paying in your short-term fund. They're paying up higher interest rates than that. So obviously, they must be doing it for all the social rates.
Mr. Chair, with either the dash fours or fives, as we would recommend they be amended, they could certainly give us the information and we will take a look at it. And if they can do it for cheaper than we can do it, meeting all of the restrictions that we have in managing those funds, we'll certainly take a look at it. I greatly doubt it. I don't think anybody runs a business, financial business, none that I have seen that does something like that for free. They get a charge out someplace down the line. But the local governments always have, this is a voluntary program, and understand that the local government investment pool is a voluntary program that local governments voluntarily put their money with us to manage because they get a profit from it and a good profit from it. We don't require them to participate. If they want to take it someplace else, if they want to take it to the company that's managing your money and they feel like it's safe and secure and they can get the kinds of returns that they want to get, they're certainly free to do that at no charge. There's no obligation whatsoever for them to participate in this fund.
This is a question to Lala, or maybe you could just, as more of a statement, maybe just tell us why was LGIP set up? I mean, it was to help particularly smaller entities, as I recall, so they could pool their money for their basis and get the economies of scale by pooling. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's precisely right. And I think if you look at what happens if the pool diminishes, the costs per unit increase, they go up. That's why keeping it at a $6 billion pool is great. Keeping the two pools together, segregating the cost is a great idea. And it really works well and serves local governments well, has served them since the inception of the program. That's why they have approximately $3 billion in the fund. They're not held captive by anyone. They can take the money out anytime they want to take it. If they can get a better investment anywhere in the world, they can take it to that place and get the investment. All we're asking for is that we be able to retrieve our cost. If it becomes onerous to the local government, they can pull their money out. With your amendments, that would be we would also then have review of whether our charges are fair and equitable. And if there's a better or cheaper way that can be done, that can be debated at the budget session. But again, I remind you that we're fiduciaries of the fund, and if we can find a cheaper, safer, better way of doing it, we continuously look for it, and we'll embrace it.
Raleigh, the bill, Senate 194, as it came from the Senate, talks about commingling of the LGIP should it drop below $125 million. What's my understanding is that was commingled some time ago into the general, into a fund that includes other state agency funds. And so it really isn't like you are maintaining the LGIP as a separate fund you manage entirely separately, as you may have at one time. What you're asking for here is not only to be able to raise your basis points on the LGIP, but on the entire $6 billion fund. And I'm just not convinced that it's warranted to be able to move that down to 6.50 at this point. And it seems to be not so much of a service to local government as it's not so much of a going out of your way kind of service, as if you were still maintaining that fund completely separately. This is Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, question for Rollins and the statement too, but at the same time, if the local governments are dissatisfied with the potentially higher rates in terms of the basis points, they can withdraw their money and go somewhere else. But I was going to ask the question of, it appears to me from talking to a few people outside of this room that the past couple of years and maybe past decade, the Treasurer's Office has become more cognizant of who's picking up the bills for things. And with some of those parties, obviously you're managing numerous funds on behalf of different agencies, different governmental entities.
some of them have kind of questioned whether they were subsidizing somebody else. At least I had a discussion with one agency that said it hadn't come up in part of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that's right on point. We have a letter from the Attorney General that says very clearly that, in fact, those agencies and those other funds should not and cannot underwrite the cost of the local government investment pool. It is very clear. We've asked that the letter be restated and rethought, and in fact it was restated and rethought, and so we're very comfortable that in fact we do not have the legal authority, which is why I say that the fund would have to be shut down. I've asked a question of the Attorney General, what happens when you cross that line? They said you no longer have the authority. You do not have the authority to underwrite the fund with any of the other funds that we have discussed. They're on point. We do not have that authority. The other agencies, there are agencies who have a fiduciary responsibility. Veterans is one that has expressed a very clear concern to us, and it has been discussed in this committee before. They will not allow it to happen. We can't allow it to happen. So once we cross that line, we're in trouble. Once we cross the 25 basis points line, we're in trouble. I think it's, in deference to the chair, I think we know how to manage these dollars, and if you look at how we've managed the dollars in the past, there's never been any question about whether we've been able to optimize the returns and we have done so, and what our costs are. Our costs have always been low. I think if you look at the response that the Budget Committee had when it reviewed our budget, we got a standing round of applause from the Budget Committee. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or not. They stood and applauded the budget we presented because it was so tight. It is a very tight budget that we manage under. I'm suggesting to you that when we make an estimate that the 0.5 basis points is what it's going to take to get us through the next biennium, that it potentially could get there, that we potentially could have in charge up there, that it's made from our best efforts. That is our best judgment. And it's not my best judgment. I'm not a financial expert. We have financial experts and advisors that help us come to those numbers, and I'm suggesting to you that that is our best guess of what we need to protect this fund. And it's no skin, I guess, off the Treasury's nose if we have to shut it down. We just have to shut it down. It's an extraordinary disservice to local government. They like the fund. They support the fee increases that we have, as well as the increase in basis points. We will not charge up to 50 basis points. Capriciously, we will just recover our flat costs from the fund. So I don't see where the danger is. And in fact, I embrace your thought, Chair Simmons, of having to do the report. And I have no problem with submitting a report to LFO. I have no problem in having LFO, if they wish to convene, have the treasurer appear before the e-board and justify any of the expansion of those fees, that we do so. I have no problem with sharing it with anybody. Any of the companies that Representative Fire or you have talked to that think they can do this better, that for apples, comparing apples to apples, no problem with sharing that information with them either. None. If we can find a cheaper, better way of doing it, we need a cheaper, better way of doing it, and we'll embrace it. But what I'm saying is that we've made our best effort projections that we need up to 50 basis points to be able to keep this fund secure and safe and not have any other portions of any other agencies or funds underwrite those costs.
I have a question just in the question to Chairman Kraft, I guess. Did we adopt the dash to this year, which was the energy portion? Remember, it was
No, we did not.
On
the debt to the energy portion, and then there was that in the both those same amendments we put in 2938 earlier today. And why are we putting both those in this bill also?
I only was aware of the Separate Office of Energy and seeing today's response.
Mr. Vincent, do you want to speak to that?
Steve Vincent, Utilities. In the event a House bill that gets to the House floor Tuesday, Wednesday, gets to the Senate, we sign and die on Friday. So,
We were looking at 194, it's not continue to tag the Office of Energy Amendment onto, and it has the wrong relating to clause to get the other amendment in, so that's why it's not a part of that. So, just another avenue.
Is the language of this amendment identical to the language in the other bill? Because if we did them in both, we wouldn't be a conflict if they were both adopted.
They're exactly the same.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, under Section 7 of the bill, when it speaks about the full movement of the funds, and it's using the $125 million threshold as to when they shall be commingled, or if it's above that, they can be uncommingled. If the local investment pool is, last month, $3.1 billion, at what point in time do you plan on unmingling them and using them as separate funds? It seems to me that we could see a more accurate picture of legislators what it's actually costing in each of these funds. If we unmingled them, we would not have this confusion, I guess, is the best word for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Breyer, I think we can show you exact figures, of what it costs to manage them both as commingled funds. We have the ability, even though the dollars are commingled, we have the ability to run exact costs on what it costs us to run those funds, and you get the same information as if they were separate. We have that sophistication in how, and I think any large financial institution would have the sophistication to break up those costs. I don't think we lose anything in terms of clarity, and that information is certainly available through our budget. When we go through our budget, we go into great detail on that, and we can present that at any time you'd like to see it, what those separate costs are. I don't think we gain anything. In fact, I think we lose by uncommingling them right now. We would have to have a separate cost and operations for both. We would gain nothing. They've been commingled for a long time. We can segregate the costs. We know what the costs are for both funds, and I think that's no benefit for separating them. It's just a good business decision to have them together because we can cross allocate exactly what the costs are now.
Mr. Chairman,
Matt,
I might ask you a couple more questions before hell week is over.
I'm going to get a tattoo also.
We all get to go through this,
I've
noticed in your testimony today, you did say you've managed to hold the 0.25 line. It's just been a problem. And that then occurred to me, with the 0.35, you're expressed concern about it because you're being properly conservative and cautious about these boundaries. What are your projections about the chances that you could live with the 0.35 for the next couple of years and then be able to respond if that's a problem?
Mr. Chair, I can give you our estimates. I can't tell you when the market is going to go kind of wild on us and rates go up. We've been dancing around it now for about a year. There's been a lot of talk about when the market is going to be the bond market is going to start moving, when the Fed is going to make some bumps. In fact, they did so recently. People expect that it could get a little bit more volatile in the next year or so. Our projections would take us into somewhere in the next year. If we drop to 3.5 billion dollar range for the total funds, that would be 4.1 basis points to recover the cost for operating the fund. So it's conceivable that 3.5 would take us there sometime potentially in the next year. I've asked our people that question. I said, based on your best estimates of how this fund can go, when do you think we cross the line at 2.5? And they say definitely in the next year is their best. And understand that's a guess. Nobody knows what the interest rate environment is going to do. So if we don't do anything, the axe drops probably within a year.
Is there a way of dancing around the figure by changing this maximum to say something else?
I don't understand.
Well, such as average of annual average of 0.35 basis points.
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. I think once it crosses and once you cross the average, you shut the fund down. And I see no reason why not have the 5 basis points. We'll do a report to suggest that if it can be done cheaper in the private sector, that will be before the legislature, before the e-board. And if, in fact, it can be done cheaper, we'll hold our feet to the fire. I would hate to get in a position where we would have to shut the fund down. It's, you know, this is what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid putting local governments in a position
that they're going to pay more money. I don't believe you're ever going to shut the fund down. I really don't.
Mr. Chair, let me tell you, and be as clear as can be, the second that we cross that 0.25, we will shut the fund down. I'm telling you, we have the Attorney General's opinion that tells us we must do it. We've got PERS that tells us that they will sue. We've got...
You can shut down. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, can we at least move the dash to?
We can move the dash.
Let's move the dash to. I move the dash to in this law. At least find it.
And a motion to court to move the dash 2 into Senate Bill 194. The objection to move the dash 2 into Senate Bill 194. Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Byer, do you move the dash?
Whatever.
5 into Senate Bill 194.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 into Senate Bill 194.
Part of the motion to court to move the dash 5 into Senate Bill 194.
I'd like to amend the motion to strike lines 3 and 4.
Because of a motion to amend the motion,
Mr. Chair,
Justin Blair,
I believe that would take the motion of the rule.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend the rule.
And the rules, the person to the motion.
To the motion?
To the motion.
Mr. Chairman, my colleagues have been very considerate. I realize sometimes we have to do a procedural dance, but in light of the amount of consideration they've demonstrated, considering the constraints of being in a minority, I would support the suspension of the rules to allow this issue to be addressed.
Alrighty, the motion then to suspend the rules. Call the roll on the motion, please. Laura, if you see any other objection. Okay, hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for letting us do that. Again, my motion would be, and I got to read off my motion, to strike lines, actually, let me restate that, lines 1 through 4. So we just create a new section 8.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm not going to support that particular motion, but after we're done, I'm going to propose an alternative. Obviously, the issue is how far they can go, and I'd say that I thought that before the Representative Devlin was pretty much on the mark when he suggested that perhaps a lower figure at 4 or 5 would at least demonstrate that we understand it. There's plenty of margin there. And it seems to me that that might be the trick, but I don't think we need to leave the 0.50 in there in the bill.
Chair?
Yes, Mr. Blair.
I believe Raleigh's own testimony said that when the fund gets to $3.5 billion, they will hit the 0.41 basis point number. The fund is at $6.169 billion now. If you look back in the history of the fund, where they, as he also testified, they lost $500 million when the interest rates went up 2 or 3 weeks ago. If you look back through the history of the fund, the fund increases every either October or November. If you look back through this, I've got the paper I have, and I think everyone has it. Goes back to January '94. That's when local property taxes hit comes in. The fund has not been $3.5 billion since October of 94, the last time the fund was that level. The dash 5 we have in front of us allows it to go to 0.35 basis points, where we did not hear when they would hit
0.35 basis points, it would be somewhere above $3.5 billion, because the $3.5 billion figure was when they would hit 0.41 basis points. So if we can assume, I'm going to guess, $3.754 billion, somewhere in that range, to get 3.35 basis points, the fund has not been to that level since February of 95. And with, if you look at the fund, it traditionally takes a jump when property taxes come in. I don't think it's very reasonable that the next 2 years, if the fund is at the 0.35 basis point figure, will actually get broken. So I believe it's a 0.35 or 0.35 basis point is an adequate amount for the next 2 years, and then certainly it can come back and be revisited again at that time.
That's true. I think Representative Beyer is probably right. In fact, maybe highly probably right. My concern is we're setting a statutory maximum.
I do disagree with the suggestion that the fund has to be shut down. I think that the emergency board would be asked to step in with authorization to keep the fund open. It would have to be some funds that were made available specifically for that purpose. But I would hate to see us in that situation. I like the idea of the report. I think the key to this amendment is the reporting, the documentation about the management cost. That's what's going to get us somewhere. So we'll have some nice tracking and reporting, and we'll understand what the private market's doing on a comparative basis. And again, this particular amendment just gets us to the 0.50. I did enjoy the colloquy about Representative Tiernan, because terrible Bob Tiernan, as he is sometimes known, also does a lot of investment work and counseling with his clients. And he and I disagreed on a number of things, but I always respected his prescience about financial matters. And I thought it was interesting that he thought that they needed a higher protection point, too. But after this particular motion, I don't think we need to go all the way to the 0.50 that's in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Again, appreciate that observation, although I guess, again, historically we've had 0.5 in the law. They came in, in fact, I'll confess, I believe I was part of this, with the Treasury when the legislature reduced this rate, and they've come and made a clear statement that there's a need to raise it back up. As has been described, it's a voluntary pool. People can come and go. As has been described, it's been described, interest rates go up, people jump out. I've got a number of contacts. People have contacted me by mail, probably everybody on this committee, about who are utilizing the pool. They're saying, well, this is a good bill. So I'm not sure who's concerned here. We're just trying to pick something. Maybe we'll go up to 0.5. Let's hope not, but I'm not willing to take the risk of having this pool and go through this exercise in the e-board analysis. I'm not sure. This thing shuts down. You're going to have a lot of local governments scrambling around, and I don't want that around my neck. So there's no reason to take that risk, period. So that's why I believe this motion to strike these sections is laudable in Section 8. And maybe that will give us some insight into some of the concerns that we raised by Representative Beyer and the chair about whether these funds are being managed in a way that's competitive. And I think you're going to find that they are.
Pushing
start.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My understanding that Treasurer charges local governments before to use this fund the cost of using it. And the letters that I have, I'd agree with Representative Edwards that the local governments are pretty happy to be able to have this available to them and support that.
Okay. Well, that gets us a long way.
I'm the vote, Mr. Chair.
And will you retake the motion?
My motion is to strike again on the proposed Senate Bill 194-5, lines 1 through 4, so that we basically have Section 8 being created in the recording.
Okay.
I thought you were striking lines 3.
Well, line 1 seems to be you're inserting this new provision. Correct.
I still think you need lines 1 and 2. I think you just need to delete.
Okay. All right. I will amend my motion then to say lines 3 and 4.
The original motion that was run by Representative Edwards was to delete lines 1 through 5.
Oh, this
on the amendment. That's what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I would like to have the tape
or some recorded, because that was the motion that I heard, that delete lines 1 through 5 on the amendment.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I heard line 3 and 4.
Yes, sir. That's what I thought I heard.
Mr. Chairman, for ease, could we have Rickson and Edwards withdraw all the previous motions and make
Actually, that's why we always have the chair state the motion just before we vote, so that when in doubt, we'll know exactly what the chair thinks the motion is.
That's very important.
Thank you. I restate my motion, Mr. Chair. My motion is to amend the Dash 5 amendment, as is in front of us, to delete lines 3 and 4.
Okay, that's the motion then, and we have rule suspension, and we can vote on this motion. And before we do, I think Kennedy just went here, right? We call the roll on the motion. We call the roll.
Representative
Byer? No. Representative Edwards? Aye. Representative Gardner? Aye. Representative
Manning? No. Representative
Starr? No. Kirsten? No. Motion having not received
the required majority is defeated. Mr. Chairman, the table. Representative Nett. I move that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting the conceptual amendments to the Dash 5 amendment.
Because we have another request for suspension of the rules for purposes of adopting conceptual amendments to the Dash 5. This is Byer.
Mr. Chair, I believe I may have been in error the last time. I said we need to suspend the rules to amend the motion. I was looking at Ramona, and she said we don't need to suspend rules.
The last one you did not, because it was before you. Right. It's only connected in writing to suspend rules.
Every time you have
to. Representative Edwards' motion is to delete.
Line 4,
you
could
see
what those were when you can capture them,
and
if you don't have
it
in
writing,
I
don't know what the motion
would
be for
that
amendment. I can't tell you
what it is.
You need it.
Not this time. I withdraw that motion, Mr. Chairman. I move that we amend the Dash 5 amendments on line 3 and 4 to change the 0.35 to 0.45.
Okay, so the motion to change the 0.35 to 0.45, and I would prefer that was 0.40.
I got enough promotion.
0.40. Okay.
That made my body.
And for that conceptual, we need a suspension of the rules.
Well, it wasn't conceptual, I think, since I'm simply changing a figure, but Ramona Kennedy will let us know.
Yours is conceptual
because
it wasn't in writing.
Right.
What I just said.
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules.
Okay. So the motion to suspend the rules for purposes of conceptual amendments to Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 194. Is there any other stated objection? Without any noted objections, the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chairman.
Trustee Matt.
I move that we change lines 3 and 4 where it says 0.35 to be 0.40.
Calls the motion before us to change 0.35 to 0.40 on line 3 and 4 of the Dash 5 amendment. Is there any...
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I move to amend Representative Mannix's motion to change it to
0.43.
Which binds us to biennium.
Binds us to biennium.
Maybe.
Okay. The most
art and
the most.
Hey, how?
Mr. Chairman, make a comment.
Yes.
If you made a comment, if you want to object. My wife would have heard you that make that comment. She would have been upset.
She wants you home. Subtle messages.
Yes, very.
Okay. And your motion is to go to 4.43.
4.43 on lines 3 and 4 of the Dash 5 amendment.
President Byers?
Once again, Mr. Chair, I believe we, I guess we already have a rule suspended, so we're okay.
We're moving.
The rules are suspended.
It allows for
conducting amendments,
the same amendment that
he's
Okay. Will the clerk please call the roll on the motion?
Is there a liar?
No.
President
Edwards?
Aye.
President Edwards?
Aye.
President Gardner? Aye. President Barr? Aye. Chairson? No. The motion
carries. Mr. Chairman. And the, we changed the 0.40 to 0.43
on line 3 and 4 of the dash 5 amendment.
That's now pending. We've amended the amendment.
Okay. Right. Okay. Will you please call the roll?
President Meyer?
Aye.
President Devlin?
Aye.
President Edwards?
Aye.
President Gardner?
Aye.
President Manning?
Aye.
President Starr?
Aye.
Chairson?
Aye. Will we limit here a little?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, President Meyer.
Move the dash 4 amendment.
We move the dash 5 into the bill.
We just did.
We amended them.
Oh. Move dash 5.
Into the bill as amended.
As amended.
Okay, the motion to move the dash 5 into the bill as amended and conceptually amended, Polly. Any further discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
President Meyer?
Aye.
President Devlin?
Aye.
President
Edwards? Aye.
President Gardner?
Aye.
President
Byrne?
Aye.
President
Starr? Aye. Chairson?
Aye.
Motion carries. President Byrne, you move
dash 4.
Dash 4. Okay. Motion before us, colleagues, move the dash 4 amendment to present Bill 194. Any further discussion?
Why, Chairman?
Mr. Chair.
President Edwards.
Ask for suspension of the rules for an amendment. Conceptual amendment.
Okay, we have another request for suspension of the rules for purposes of the conceptual amendment to the dash 4 or to which?
To the dash 4. Mr. Chair, just so you understand where I'm going, I do believe you got a problem with lines 15 through 17 on a constitutional basis, and I should know that, but it's a terrible precedent to set. So,
with all due respect, Representative Edwards, I believe our folks from Legislative Council would have informed us that there was an issue.
It's unprecedented, Mr. Chair, to have another executive body, executive constitutional officer telling another one what to do. They're independent. So,
Mr. Chairman,
President Bennett.
I don't see a direct constitutional issue. I think that the legislature can fill in the interstices of the relative powers of the executive, especially since all of the governor does is request something. If the governor directed, I think legislative council may have come back and said there's a problem. In fact, we could say that the report should be submitted to the great kangaroo in Australia, and the great kangaroo in Australia may request something.
I'd move to this bill. Put that in there.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Let's finish up here in
But what I see the dash 4 amendment doing is really modifying the dash 5 to say that the governor is going to request the state treasurer to advertise a request for proposals. My own view is the key to me is that this report is going to the legislature, the legislative fiscal officer. So I'm actually going to oppose the amendment because I'm more interested in the legislature getting into this game than the governor. I see the legislature getting in the game with what we already adopted. I think the governor can make all the requests he wants, but I want us to be with our hands on the fiscal pillar.
You oppose the dash?
Yeah, I'm going to oppose the dash.
All right, well, Mr. Chair, I withdraw my request for suspension of the rule.
Do you have a previous question?
I have no
previous question. Mr. Byrd, do you withdraw your motion to move the dash fours?
Oh, let's vote on
them. Sure, I'll withdraw my motion. Okay, we will close the work session on
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Can you hit the gavel at this point? Mr. Chairman, I was prepared to make a motion this time.
Go ahead. Let's close the work session.
Do you have any others for tonight?
Nope.
That's it for tonight, and we will have 1180, 1181 tomorrow, and we will go to
amendments to 1168 tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're on.
Right, this is here.
Yes, with the buyer.
Register notice of possible reconsideration on Senate Bill 722.
Before we adjourn, the buyer wants to share notice of possible reconsideration on Senate Bill 722. Any other notices for the record?
Mr. Chairman, this is for the committee's sake. What time will we be meeting the first time tomorrow?
I need to confer with staff. I would like to get it done as early as possible, but in many cases. Why don't we schedule for 2 o'clock tomorrow, rather than trying to scramble around first thing in the morning. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Any more business for the committee?
We will adjourn.